You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Mark Dworkin. Mark Dworkin and Melissa Young are award-winning documentary film directors, veteran directors of films about social justice issues, several of which have been on PBS, and they are the directors of an important new film called Plain Truths. You can find them at movingimages.org, and you can find this new movie at plaintruths.org. Plain Truths looks at the increased activity at the U.S. Navy base on Whidbey Island in Washington State in Puget Sound, activity that is making life unbearable for locals and wildlife, collateral damage in the ever-increasing militarization of this society. Mark Dworkin, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David, and glad to be on.
Thanks for coming on, and I'm sorry that we couldn't have Melissa Young on together with you due to my own technical difficulties, and thank you for making this film. Whidbey Island in Puget Sound, tell us what sort of a place that is.
Well, it's very rural, pretty much small-town environment. Whidbey Island is actually technically the largest, the longest island in the United States. And I bring that up because the Navy base, which is a naval air station, it's airplanes that usually are on aircraft carriers, but they train at that station, naval air station. That enterprise dominates the economy of the northern end of the island. Much of the rest of the island is agricultural, small farmers, retired people, etc. The very southern end of the island is not that far from Seattle, and so there even are people who commute. The other thing about it is that the Navy Air Station has been there since 1941, but at that time there were a lot fewer people on the island, and also at that time the airplanes themselves were smaller. They weren't even jets. They were much quieter, and things have changed over the years. More people live on the island. And the jets that keep coming in, especially the latest new ones, which are the loudest jets in the world, are becoming unbearable for people.
Which kind of jets are the loudest in the world?
They're F-18s. They're called Growlers. They're made by Boeing. And I'm not a military expert. I don't think that those jets are louder than passenger planes are at airports, considerably. And my guess is that there's things that they do about passenger planes at airports to make them quieter so they don't disturb people. But that may have an effect on their performance. So these jets are unencumbered by such extra apparatus, and they are fiendishly loud.
And making life unbearable sounds like a pretty – this is more than just an annoyance. What are the impacts on people and wildlife?
Well, we notice the effects on people more here. And, for example, there's a place in which these planes practice taking off and landing so that they can do it on aircraft carriers. If you accept that we have aircraft carriers, which I think is an issue, but if you accept that we have aircraft carriers, people have to learn to take off and land on them. And they do it on solid ground first because that's easier than a ship that's bouncing around in the ocean. That place where they take off and land from is about 2 miles from the hospital, a high school, elementary and middle school. And in the classes at the schools, they have to stop when the airplanes fly over because they can't hear. And a lot of people live fairly close to where this practice field is. A good friend who's been there for 50 years, and we have visited, and in somebody's modern house with doors and windows closed, when the planes fly over, you can't hear yourself think. You can't talk to somebody. You can't have a conversation on the phone. The other thing is that there are many people who are small farmers. And, of course, when the planes are flying over, and they're out in the field and they're talking to one another about how to do whatever task they're doing at that moment, they can't communicate because they can't hear.
Yeah. I've seen studies, including from other communities opposing similar operations, that certain levels of noise have a health impact on children and on brain development. And have there been these sorts of health studies done?
Well, I don't know about the particular things you mentioned, but I do know that sound levels over a given amount, and maybe it's 100 decibels, can actually cause permanent hearing damage. And when these planes are flying overhead, people have taken readings of 120 decibels, 130 decibels, which is considerably louder.
Loud enough for permanent hearing damage.
Yes. And since you mentioned public health, we do consider the public health concerns. Another issue in the film, which I don't want to change the subject so much, but the very same air bases use chemicals and particular kinds of chemicals that are used to put out fires when there's a fire in an airplane. And they don't have that many airplane crashes, but they do have They don't have that many crashes, but they do need to practice what to do with these chemicals if there is a crash. And those chemicals have now found their way into the water table and into people's wells and into the wells of the biggest town near this airbase at levels that are above what's considered tolerable. So that's pretty amazing, too. And as we take up these issues in the film is going to be shown next month at the American Public Health Association conference in San Diego. So they see these as, you know, issues of concern for public health and have chosen to show the film for that reason.
It seems like a lot of public, not a lot, but a number of public health experts and organizations are increasingly willing to treat militarism as a public health threat. Are you finding this encouraging?
Oh, yeah. Both Melissa and I have been working together for more than 30 years. But before we knew each other, we were both quite active against the war in Vietnam. So we've had peace on our minds and U.S. military policy on our minds for some years. And what I'm noticing, some people who've tolerated some of these things until recently are beginning to oppose them. Now, part of it might be because the planes, for example, are louder. So if you're in the neighborhood and you tolerated it in the past, you might be less likely to do so now that the new planes have come in. There's also going to be a lot more flights. Instead of about 6,000 operations a year, there will be 25,000 operations a year. So there's going to be flying overhead much more often every day, sometimes until late at night. Somebody that we interviewed, who's an 85-year-old farmer, grew up not too far from the airstrip where this practice goes on. He said to us, and we included in his remarks in the film, he said that he's a proud veteran of the Korean War. His ancestors fought in the Civil War. He said, we support our boys, we support our country, we accept that we have a military and we might need it for defending ourselves. These are his ideas. But he didn't accept it, that these kind of planes and that they and their practices that are going on there and their seeming lack of concern for collateral damage, I like the term you used.
Oh, I got it from you.
He said, the Navy defends this by saying we need it for our national security. And he said, I don't believe it. Prove it. I don't believe it. So I think that's part of it, is that with all these years, especially mature people like ourselves, have seen U.S. military get bigger and bigger and bigger and more expansive around the world, and themselves are thinking, how much more do we need?
Yeah.
And maybe it makes them less tolerant. Yeah.
I'm skeptical enough to wonder whether the gentleman would be actively working against this if it were in someone else's backyard, given that he believes destroying Korea was necessary for the national defense. But
he didn't actually say that. He might have done it because he was certainly a younger guy at the time, and he might have done it because he accepted things.
Sure.
But, you know, he's a farmer. I think he's a wonderful guy. He's a farmer, and, you know, what he looks at very closely and intimately is the land that he farms and the people in his own community.
Right.
And is paying less attention to what might happen in San Diego, where there are similar problems.
You raised an interesting question earlier in that, you know, these planes are obviously not intended for some sort of supposed military defense of Washington State, but rather for aircraft carriers that are sent around the world. Is that a distinction that you found relevant to people you interviewed?
People are hesitant to say things criticizing the U.S. military and criticize because they're afraid they'll be seen as unpatriotic. But yes, for sure. In fact, the shift of having so many more of those planes here on the West Coast has to do with what Obama called the pivot to Asia. It has to do with U.S. military and foreign policy looking more at China as a potential enemy or certainly an adversary. And your point about aircraft carriers is a good one. We don't need aircraft carriers to defend our country. Whoever wants to come and attack, we have plenty of airstrips on solid ground from which U.S. planes could take off to fight back. The only thing that aircraft carriers are good for is sending your forces far away and giving them a platform to take off from. And in my opinion, that has a lot to do with an overextension of U.S. military policy and meddling in places that we really don't need to be.
We are speaking with Mark Dworkin, and the film we're speaking about is Plain Truths. You can go to plaintruths.org to learn more. The local people are not all just sitting back and taking this. There is activism going on. There's a group called the Sound Defense Alliance, sounddefensealliance.org. What is that, and what sort of tactics are people using to try to stop these planes?
Well, I'm glad you brought it up. There have been groups concerned about these issues, taking steps against them on Whidbey Island, on the mainland, both east and west of Whidbey Island. Puget Sound is in the western part of Washington State, but there's land to the west and there's land to the east. And there have been local groups in various communities that have each had their own take opposing these things. And the Sound Defense Alliance is something that came together in the last few months, where as these groups found out about one another and realized they had common concerns, they thought, well, if they could coordinate their efforts and work together, maybe they would be more effective. And so one of the things that they've done, there are lawsuits in the works, suing the Navy, challenging the decision they made to have more planes here and more flights, and calling upon them to do it in a place where it would affect people less, a place where there's not so many folks living. Other things that are happening is they're having lots of screenings of our film Plain Truth, and it's about a half an hour long, so in a community screening, we've been at many, there's lots of chance for people in the audience to talk and put their own ideas out about what they do and do not like and what they'd like to do about it. And we were at such a screening recently, not far from where we live, and about 110 people there. One of the people who was facilitating the session after the film was shown urged people to take their phones, take pictures of people in the room, and to post it on Facebook with an explanation of why they were there. And social media are a way to spread the word on things, and so they're making some creative use of that. Something else that happened just last week was near the site of where these airplanes are taking off and landing and bothering people so much, about 500 or 600 people by prior arrangement showed up with big cardboard cards that were either dark gray or white, and they held them over their heads. And we've seen this kind of thing on television at sporting events and show on.
Right.
Somebody had figured out a pattern so that when they held these cards over their heads, it spelled out the words, "We hear you. Do you hear us?" And the idea was holding these up as if the jets were flying overhead, they could see this and get the message. So people are doing various things they can think of to draw attention to the issue, to get more people to get involved, to have them write to their congresspeople and so on, in hopes of at least diminishing what's going on, if not really changing it a lot.
And there's a nice little video of that action with the big cards that people can see at sounddefensealliance.org.
Yes.
I always find it myself very encouraging when local campaigns like this get environmental groups or local chapters of environmental groups and peace groups on board with the same thing, because at the national or global level, environmental organizations want nothing whatsoever to do with peace. Even groups with peace in the name, like Greenpeace, will not touch peace with a 10-foot pole. And I wonder how that alliance works at the local level there.
Well, it is happening. And, you know, to the extent that I know people who were involved, I mean, I've lived here for almost 50 years, and a lot of the people that I know who were involved are equally, in their own, as individuals, they're equally concerned about peace and militarism and environmental justice and climate change. So, and that's probably true of a lot of environmentalists out there that really are concerned about peace issues, but their organizations don't want to take it up. In this case, they're taking it up.
Yeah.
I was going to mention one other thing, too.
Please.
A lot of the people, many people on WIDBY, I mean, don't say a lot, but quite a few, especially the northern end, are retired military. And they choose to retire not too far from a Navy base or any military base because they get to use the base hospital, they get to shop at the base department store and grocery store, and they get to save a lot of money that way on things and get good services that they're pleased with. At any rate, many of those people who themselves are retired military are opposing what's going on with the airplanes. And when we found that out, it was a big incentive to us to make this film, because a big concern is that people will say, oh, you don't want to defend our country. Oh, you peaceniks, you're no good. I'm sure you've run across this. And so we begin and end the film with a retired Navy captain who happens to live in the area. And he wrote an op-ed piece in the Seattle Times, which is the big newspaper in Seattle, condemning what the Navy is doing. And he made it clear to us. He made it clear in the op-ed piece, which is how we learned about him. He also made it clear to us when we met him and interviewed him that he spent 24 years in the Navy. He had a high position at the Pentagon at the end of his career. He's not ashamed of the Navy. He has nothing against the Navy. He supports the U.S. military. But it doesn't mean he supports every single thing they do. And he's really strong about what they've been doing here, that's wrong. And so he's making a distinction between, in his judgment, what's necessary to defend the country and the kinds of things that are going on. And not only that, but when we finished the film and sent him a link so that he could see it, he sent that on to a lot of press around the Pentagon, including the New York Times Pentagon correspondent, a lot of other both active duty and retired Navy people that he knows from his experiences, because he senses that there's a lot of dissension about some things like this, but it doesn't mean people are bold enough to speak out.
Yeah. Well, it's good for everyone to at every level to move as far as they are willing in the right direction, and it certainly helps to have those sorts of spokespeople in the film and promoting the film. As someone who doesn't believe the U.S. Navy serves a useful purpose and doesn't believe it's a force for good in the world or protecting anyone, but rather endangering them, I still have to wonder when I go to sounddefensealliance.org and at the very top it says, "For decades, Northwest Washington state communities have been willing partners with the military in protecting our national security." And I wonder whether promoting the idea that the military protects people ends up helping the cause or hurting it. Because if you are going to believe the military protects you, you're going to be willing to put up with certain things, aren't you?
It's true. Although in the example I gave, the Navy, retired Navy officer who's in our film, he does believe the military protects us, but he also thinks what they're doing here is wrong. But I would go on to say, I can't speak for the folks that put together the Sound Defense Alliance. I mean, I respect them and so on.
Right.
But they're their own thing. I can't speak for them officially, but I can offer the opinion that they're being cautious. that they don't want people in the area that otherwise think the military is okay to condemn them and not be willing to listen to their concerns.
Of course.
So maybe they're being, you know, stepping too far in that direction.
Is the demand, and I guess I mean the demand from them or from particular groups or from what you think the demand should be, to end these flights, or is it to keep them at their current disastrous level rather than significantly increasing them?
Some people say they want them to go away, and I would say that's a minority. I wouldn't mind if they went away personally. But some people want them to go away. Others say they don't want them to increase the numbers that they have. So a few years ago, when the new airplanes, these Growlers, came on board and were beginning to fly, we heard from some friends, people I've known for 40 years, who live nearby, who got in touch with us and said, this is driving us crazy. The old planes were bad enough, but we learned to live with them. This is this major assault on our quality of life. Could you please come up and do some filming to show people? We can put it online, and we did that. And at that time, it was not yet projected that the numbers of flights would increase as much as they will. So it has been on the order of 5,000 or 6,000 operations per year. It's now projected to go to 25,000. And that means more hours per day, more days per year, and so on. Something else I wanted to mention, and we bring it up in the film, we're in an area that has a lot of national parks. There's actually a small national park on Whidbey Island itself. But the major national park is to the west in the Olympic Mountains, Olympic National Park. There's also a national park or something like a national park among some other islands to the north of us, the San Juan Islands.
Right.
These airplanes will be flying over those places more than in the past. It's now projected that they'll be flying every single weekday of the year over the Olympic National Parks. And the sound from those jets is clearly disturbing to animals. It will affect, you know, whether they can sleep and their mating habits and so on. The other thing is that the mission of these jets, when they take off, they're meant to be based on aircraft carriers. But what they do when they take off in the aircraft carrier is not just to go drop bombs on somebody, as other jets do, but rather to do what's called electronic warfare. And so they send out powerful electronic signals that are meant to neutralize the radar of the adversaries in a battle. And what they're doing flying over the Olympic Peninsula in the national park is within the national park on forest service roads, there will be trucks with radar on them that will be driving around and sending out radar. And these jets' job is to spot them, detect the radar signal, and neutralize it, or at least do something that shows that if it were a real battle situation, they could have neutralized it.
Yeah.
The effect of all of that is a vast flood of radiation from these electronics, which are dangerous. It's dangerous to be too close to a microwave oven all the time, which is similar to radar.
Yeah.
And so there's some real concerns about what that's going to do.
And it's not what national parks are meant to be for.
It's not, and right. And plus, the Olympic National Park, many people that we've spoken with say that the Olympic National Park is probably the quietest place in the United States. But of course, with these jets flying over, it's not.
That's going to change. You know,
yep.
I think the first place I learned about this was in some articles by a journalist friend named Dar Jamal, who's written about this issue. And he wrote about an economic study of the Navy base that suggested that it's in fact an economic drain on the region. All of the costs, all of the lost opportunity costs, all of the external costs of the damage and so forth, and health costs. I don't know if that makes any difference to someone who has a job with the Navy and wants their job, and nobody's offering them any other job. But does it help this campaign to show people that, in fact, military spending is an economic drain rather than an economic boost?
It's a very good question. Dar Jamal is a friend. He appears in our film. We had met him previously, but we saw the very same articles he wrote that made it, and we appreciate him as a very fine researcher and an ethical person. So we interviewed him. And the study was done by a guy named Michael Schumann. He was hired by a local group. And the content of the study, you were more or less on track, but I can refine your explanation a little bit.
Sure.
The Navy base itself has an annual payroll of $750 million. $750 million. That's a lot of money. That's money coming, that's in principle, in name, coming into Whidbey Island. That wouldn't come otherwise. It would be hard to find an industry of that magnitude that would bring that much money in. Having said that, the study addresses what are the costs associated with that. So, for example, as they bring more people into the city of Oak Harbor, which is the biggest city on Whidbey, it's up where the Navy base is located, there's more kids in the schools. And that, that if they live in houses on the military base, there's no property taxes that are paid. So the schools have additional burdens on them in that city, as do the roads, as do the sewage systems, various things, by having more people living there that are not compensated by the government.
Yeah.
So there's some serious losses of income that way. And it becomes like the way the pattern is actually in a lot of other places that you've probably considered over the years. Some people are getting a lot of money out of the deal. Other people are not. And it's important to make that distinction.
And
also, another part of the study is that, yes, there's thousands of people living up there who are employed by the Navy. So they're on that payroll of $750 million a year. But if they shop at the supermarket on the military base, which all the military personnel are certainly entitled to do, there's no sales tax paid, so it doesn't go to the state, doesn't go to the city, and that's the principal source of income
right.
for the government here. So
Mark,
even though a lot of money's coming in, sometimes it's spent in ways that don't the benefits don't go aren't widespread.
Mark Dworkin, we could go on for hours. I think it's a wonderful film. We have less than a minute left. I want to tell people they can go to worldbeyondwar.org and work with a local chapter of our organization and get a discount from you guys generously on doing a community screening. And they can also buy a DVD or stream online or find screenings at your website, correct?
Yes. I can mention also that it will be showing at the American Public Health Association conference in San Diego. Now, that's for people, it's for professionals. So it would be people going to the conference already and paying the fees to enter. It's also showing in a film festival coming up soon in about 2 weeks on one of the islands in the San Juan Islands. And it's called the Friday Harbor Film Festival. It's October 26th and 27th that it will be showing.
We'll have to leave it there. Find more screenings at plaintruths.org. Mark Dworkin, thank you very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the horror stories are real, about migrant children pulled from their parents at the U.S.-Mexico border, sometimes locked in cages, sometimes given up for adoption, while ostensibly waiting to be reunited with families the government had no plan for reuniting them with. But when corporate media tell the story through the White House's cruel prism, even if they criticize it, they're obscuring ideas and actors that are moving things in a more humane direction. We'll talk about why it matters who you talk to with Tina Vasquez, senior immigration reporter at Rewire.news. Also on the show, if it's a new day, you're right to ask if the Trump administration is coming for your rights in a new way. And the answer is yes. The White House is now, via the National Park Service, seeking to squelch public protest in Washington, D.C. by charging for it. Because the important thing about Martin Luther King's March on Washington is how much it costs to fix the lawn. It's not hard to see through this anti-democratic ploy, but what does it take to fight it? We'll hear from Mara Verheyden-Hilliard, executive director of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. All of that's coming up, but first, a very quick look back at recent press. CNN International tweeted on October 14th, quote, "Scared by that new report on climate change? Here's what you can do to help. Eat less meat. Swap your car or plane ride for a bus or train. Use a smart thermostat in your home and upgrade to more efficient appliances." Close quote. To which FAIR analyst Adam Johnson replied, quote, "Reminder that 100 corporations are responsible for 71% of global greenhouse gas emissions, and presenting the crisis as a moral failing on the part of individuals without noting this fact is journalistic malpractice," close quote. Johnson was citing data from the Carbon Disclosure Project's Carbon Majors report, which tracks greenhouse gas emissions and traces them to for-profit and state-owned entities. The report also found that since 1988, just 25 such enterprises were responsible for more than half of all greenhouse gas emissions. A check of the Nexus News database shows that CNN, like most corporate news outlets, has never mentioned the Carbon Majors report, which includes many major media advertisers on its list. CNN will, however, keep you informed on your need to buy a more energy-efficient refrigerator. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. In a typical corporate media story on the family separations and deportations and asylum denials that define immigration policy under Donald Trump, the images and sometimes voices of immigrants are essentially illustrative. They add color and specificity, but their actions don't generally set the frame of the story. The objects of policy, immigrants still somehow are not the central subjects, the main drivers of the story of their lives. Centering immigrants and their agency changes the fabric of reporting and shifts this static understanding of the situation, opening ways forward beyond the logjam of hopelessness and frustration so many now feel. Tina Vasquez is the senior immigration reporter at Rewire.news. She joins us now by phone from North Carolina. Welcome back to Counterspin, Tina Vasquez.
Thank you for having me.
Amnesty International released a report just last week, USA, You Do Not Have Any Rights Here, documenting multiple sorts of abuses at the U.S.-Mexico border involving punishing asylum seekers. I suppose I was somewhat surprised to see it ignored by so-called mainstream media. There was a piece on Newsweek online. Voice of America actually ran something. But for a report that pulled together a number of current concerns, including how Customs and Border Protections are defining family, I guess I hoped for more. But you reported on this for Rewire. What did you find important in that Amnesty report that people should know about?
I guess what I found most shocking is the number of families that were actually separated, how even though Amnesty provided an update number that's more than double what was originally reported. So Amnesty is reporting that more than 6,000 families were separated at the border, and that the Trump administration's family separation policy that was announced or confirmed by Jeff Sessions, and I believe it was April 2018, it actually started to get rolled out quietly in July of 2017. And so they think that it impacted 15,000 individual people and more than 6,000 families. And that still is just an estimate, because when the policy was being rolled out more quietly with less oversight and without any sort of eyes on it publicly, there's really no telling how many families were subjected to the policy, how many families remained separated, or how many children were kind of disappeared into a system and their parents as well deported to never be seen again. It was a really shocking report, and that was just one part of it. You mentioned a lot of the abuses that they're seeing. A great deal of attention is devoted to the treatment of transgender women in particular who are migrating to the U.S. seeking asylum. Women in the report being sexually abused and assaulted in detention, being detained alongside men, and really having no recourse, not receiving medical care for things that they need. It's a wide swath of abuses that cover very, very vulnerable people.
One of the authors of the report indicated that in some of the situations, the behavior actually conforms to international recognized criteria for torture.
Yeah, I mean, I also spoke to an immigration attorney who told me he's representing some of the clients that were in the report, and that he certainly thinks of this as torture, and it falls along those lines and those definitions, because the psychological damage that parents experience, not knowing where their children are for so long, not knowing if they will see them again, and of course there's the damage that the children experience, some are reporting that could be irreparable. It's been such a disturbing, harmful, I can't use the word I want to use. It's been a mess, and now the Trump administration is considering rolling it out again. So the public outcry, while really overwhelming at times, and it seemed to be the reason why the executive order was signed, it didn't seem enough to stop the Trump administration from continuing this policy.
Well, part of what informative reporting like yours does is demonstrate continuity and disjuncture in immigration policies and practices. It's not about Obama versus Trump or Democrats versus Republicans. You know, it's you know, do we want a humane, welcoming society, and how do we go towards that? Or do we want a racist and nativist one? You know, things can have happened before and still be worse now. And that seems very important to underscore and to make sense of.
If nothing else, what I hope that my reporting does is it makes it clear, and I'm really unapologetic in my stance on this as a journalist. I think we're told that we're supposed to be unbiased, but I can show you facts and evidence to show you that the U.S. immigration system is inherently abusive and violent and racist. And so what you're seeing is the products of that. It's just being wielded by a different administration that is more overtly anti-immigrant and more comfortable being overtly racist. But that is always my starting point when doing immigration reporting. It doesn't matter who's in the White House. That's the starting point. The detention is inhumane and violent, and so is the immigration system.
Well, when I was talking about letting immigrants' actions set the dynamic of the story rather than the U.S. government announced this policy, here's some quotes from immigrants in response. I was thinking about recent pieces of yours, one that ran on Rewire.news and NYR, the New York Review of Books Daily, that was headlined "Abolish ICE Beyond a Slogan." I found it a very encouraging story. And just to the point that you've just made, it's reporting. It doesn't change over into some other category of thing. It's just reporting that has different actors at the center of it. And it really importantly shifts, I think, our understanding of the situation. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about reporting that story on Abolish ICE and what's coming through there.
It's something that I'm thinking about more and more. There's a queer undocumented poet named Yosimar Reyes who's been doing like a speaking tour called UndocuJoy. And he talks a lot about how we only want to show the tragedy that is what's happening to immigrants or how hard it is to be an immigrant, with no real examples of how immigrants every day don't just survive and thrive, but have full and fulfilling lives. And so that can't be at the center of all of the reporting I do as an immigration reporter, but it's something that I've been thinking about and it's been weighing on me. And so this Abolish ICE piece changed form in its reporting. Initially, it was going to be sort of an overview of like how elected officials are signing on or signing off of the movement to abolish ICE. That just didn't feel right. It didn't feel good, and it didn't reflect the interviews that I was doing. It was important to me that the piece showed the resilience of immigrant communities. So the movement to abolish ICE is led by immigrants, undocumented immigrants, and specifically brown and black, queer and trans immigrants. They are on the front lines, as they have been in many movements, and it was important to me to highlight that and to showcase their resilience and the ways that they're fighting back, and then also to sort of uplift the voices of people who don't have a lot of options but are still fighting back. That's why we showcased Jose Chicas, who's a pastor in North Carolina who's been in sanctuary for over a year unless a private bill is introduced in his name. He can't remain in the U.S., and he's stuck in a church. And people like Azul Uribe, who was deported under the Obama administration, facing a 10-year bar, and she's coming up on 9 years, and she's terrified to come back to the United States because it's an even scarier place than when she was first deported. So there's, you know, different immigrant communities have different realities and lived experiences, and I want to highlight those as much as possible and make them the story, make them the center of the story.
And when you do that, things fall out on such different lines than throughout much of reporting. The people that you talk to don't split their issue or their lives into, you know, the families versus felons, the whole good versus bad framework that the state pushes and that media too often echo. They just, that's not how they see things at all. They have a different view of it.
Yeah, there are certainly no like clear cut lines. And the example of felons, not families, is really striking to me. That's something that President Obama said. He said that, you know, we're deporting felons, not families, or that's who we're targeting. But, you know, if you are deported in the United States and you come back to try to reunite with your family, you are a felon. That's a felony. So you are both a father or a mother or a family member, and now you are a felon in the eyes of the United States. So the immigration system is messy and it's complicated, and like tidy narratives don't serve anybody.
We've been speaking with Tina Vasquez, senior immigration reporter at Rewire.news. Thank you so much, Tina Vasquez, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
What is clear is that the Trump White House wants what it wants. Decades of carefully forged law and tradition be damned. One of the things it wants is the eradication of public expressions of dissent. Donald Trump has said that protest against him and his friends should be illegal, that those who engage in it should lose their jobs and/or have violence visited upon them. If the White House can't achieve that, well, they'll get as close to it as they can, which brings us to the latest. The National Park Service, under Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke, seeking to rewrite the rules on free speech and demonstrations on those public lands that are under federal jurisdiction in Washington, D.C. That would be the parks, sidewalks, and streets in the country's capital that have seen some of the most significant public protests in U.S. history. We're joined now for an understanding of this latest assault on the First Amendment and how we push back by Mara Verheiden-Hilliard, Executive Director of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. She joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Counterspin, Mara Verheiden-Hilliard.
So glad to be with you.
Well, tell us about these proposed new rules from the National Park Service and what they would actually mean.
The National Park Service, under Secretary Zinke, under the Trump administration, has put out the most substantial overhaul of the regulations governing access to public lands in Washington, D.C. for demonstrations, we believe, in the history of the Park Service. We've never seen this massive a regulatory rewrite at one time. And these are rules that have been forged incrementally over five decades of constitutional rights litigation when time and again the Park Service has been brought before federal courts where activists have had to fight to be able to demonstrate in Washington, D.C. And these rules were put into place really to guide the hand of the Park Service so that we would be able to exercise our free speech rights without them being able to take actions to disrupt and burden that exercise. What they're trying to do is throw all of that out the window. And just so that people have an understanding of the scope of this, we're talking about all of the most sort of iconic locations when you think about the history of protests in the United States. We're talking about the National Mall, the Lincoln Memorial, the White House sidewalk, Lafayette Park, the Washington Monument grounds, the sidewalks up and down Pennsylvania Avenue, including in front of the Trump Hotel. What they have proposed has more than 14 points of rulemaking, but just to highlight some of the key provisions that are so damaging, they have put out a proposal that we've called the protest tax, where they're asking the public for, they had asked for comment on whether or not people that want to demonstrate on these public lands in Washington, D.C. should be charged for doing so. And those charges could include anything from the barricades and fencing that are set up at the discretion of the police, so, you know, they're going to pen you in and charge you for it. That could include the salaries and overtime of park officials who come out to monitor demonstrations. It could include invoices sent after the fact to demonstrators, demonstration organizers, for claimed harm to the grass that people stood upon in assembly to demonstrate. These charges could mount in the, not just the thousands, but the tens of thousands, and in fact the hundreds of thousands of dollars. So were that to succeed, it would make demonstrations just, you know, prohibitively expensive and would threaten to bankrupt grassroots organizations. And that's just one of the proposals.
Well, it sounds like there's no reason to pretend that it's really about these actual costs. I mean, it seems very clear that it's aimed at actually making it difficult or, hey, impossible to engage in public protest.
I don't think that anyone can possibly think this is simply an administrative matter. I mean, this is the Trump administration with its rhetoric against demonstrators, its hostility to the First Amendment and towards protests, taking that rhetoric and turning it into concrete plans to stifle and crush demonstrations in the nation's capital. They have in this proposal a second measure by which they would be able to charge demonstrators for the ability to demonstrate. They want to take demonstrations and give officials discretion to go through people's programs and assert that there are what they call special event elements inside a program, which, as best as we can tell, could mean, you know, anything from an exhibit like the iconic AIDS quilt exhibit, because it is not literally people speaking,
right,
to musical performances at a demonstration, which, you know, all demonstrations routinely have cultural and musical performances. I mean, you think about even the 1963 March on Washington. You know, Odetta was there, Joan Baez, Marian Anderson, you know, Bob Dylan. And now you would look at that and they would say, well, that's not, you know, appropriate demonstration activity, as if also speech set to music, you know, loses its character as speech.
And then becomes somehow under this corporate reign or something. What is even the idea that it's now it's artistic and it somehow comes under a different rubric and that's why we can charge money for it? Because after all, lots of private organizations have events on the lawn, you know.
The way that activities are handled on public space in Washington is there are demonstration activities, which is, you know, all First Amendment activity. That's handled separately because there is a fundamental understanding that that is what our public spaces are for. Our public spaces are for the public to use for free speech, for dissent, for debate, for discussion of what matters. When you come to Washington, D.C., you are at the heart of the concept of petitioning the government for a redress of grievances. That is part of the basic mission of the National Park Service. It is part of what they are supposed to do. They don't own our public spaces. The government doesn't own our public spaces. They are the stewards of our public spaces, and they are simply supposed to manage them. But they want to treat this now as if our public parks, our public lands, are somehow their property. They are the wealthy landowners, and they're letting us walk on their manicured lawns and charging us for them. It's completely different than if a special event or commercial film wants to come use space in Washington. That shouldn't be charged to the taxpayers. When Wonder Woman was here during the summer, I'm sure that costs in the many hundreds of thousands of dollars, and that is something that the Park Service is supposed to recoup from private commercial profit-making ventures. It is completely different than First Amendment activity. They want to conflate those two. On top of all this, my organization, the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, did a line-by-line review of the proposed regulations and found that they had hidden in there that they were closing the iconic White House sidewalk to protest. So this is the location that all of us can imagine people picketing and demonstrating on the sidewalk with the White House in the background, from suffrage to anti-lynching demonstrations to anti-war, civil rights, you know, environmental rights, LGBT. Everyone has gone to that location. But the Trump administration literally wants to take the ground out from underneath our feet.
Well, Ryan Zinke said, we're just putting these things out there as ideas. And, quote, we want to have a genuine conversation with the public, close quote. What that translated to was a public comment period, which I understand that it's a recognized way that these processes worked. At the same time, you know, hey, my nightly news must have missed it because I didn't hear anything trying to encourage me to engage in this public comment period about something that I might really care about, you know. So what did the process look like? And then, you know, folks did weigh in, and what happened?
They put out their proposal to public comment, which closed October 15th at midnight. And we started a massive public education and outreach campaign. We digested this nearly 100-page proposal, broke it down. We reached so many organizations and groups who were reaching their own constituencies to get public comment in. And that number, which is still going up because comments are still registering even though the period is closed, has now surpassed 70,000 comments in response to Trump's anti-protest plan. But this language from Zinke that they're just asking the question is not entirely accurate. That is true with regard to one of the proposals. But for all the rest of these extremely damaging proposals, they wrote regulations that will go into final rulemaking. And that's why we were really focused on this public comment period, to get substantial comments in, because an agency must actually consider substantive comments that are meaningful comments before it can go to final rulemaking and explain how the final rules have considered those comments. So many organizations put in very detailed, very thoughtful comments, a lot of affidavits, and so we were building this administrative record because we expect that we will be litigating to stop these regulations. We're planning to file litigation as necessary to enjoin them, but we need to have the record underneath us, which now we believe has been built, in order to effectively do that.
Well, let me just ask you what you've hinted towards it, but what's going to happen going forward? I hate to tell listeners there was a time to weigh in, but it's over. You know, obviously, these are issues that will affect all of us in a deep way going forward. And so I'd like to know kind of what's going to be happening, and what can people do about it?
Well, I think there's a lot of ongoing activity that can happen. There is a lot of public awareness and public pressure that can be brought to make this an extremely difficult process for the administration to move forward on. You know, some of the other proposals they have in here, they wrote regulations that would ban any future Occupy action. They will not allow any demonstration to exist for more than 30 days. You know, you can see what they're trying to do. They don't want any sustained presence ever existing in the nation's capital again. They have rules that would eliminate the certainty that permit applicants have when they submit applications, and change the system so that there's basically a limbo system where the Park Service can just sit on permit applications for months at a time. So for people to speak out on this and be raising awareness and increasing the demand that they rescind their plans is extremely valuable and extremely important. And we will be working with a lot of groups who are continuing to do that.
We've been speaking with Marva Hayden-Hilliard, Executive Director of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. You can follow their work and become part of it online at justiceonline.org. Marva Hayden-Hilliard, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Very glad to.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show's engineered by Erica Rosato. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShop.
This is Radio EcoShop with Alex Smith.
Raging waters so strong they swept away this bridge. The flash floods came on suddenly in this southern French town of Vidgaiac.
Portugal has been hit by a rare Atlantic hurricane, with some weather experts describing the storm as the most powerful to hit the country since 1842. The remnants of Hurricane Leslie swept across coastal areas late on Saturday, packing winds of more than 170 kilometres an hour.
Flooding and landslides caused by Storm Callum have claimed the lives of two people. A man died in Carmarthenshire following a landslide, and a second man was swept away by rough seas in Brighton.
In just 45 minutes, it rose and broke everything. He swept it all away. The trees were uprooted. And at 3:30, the bridge started to go.
The water temperature as Michael came through was in the mid-80s, so some of the warmest water of the year, and it's the warm water that fuels not only the development but the strengthening all the way up to the point that it made landfall on the Florida Panhandle, and it did so at the top of the Category 4 scale with sustained winds of 155 miles an hour, just shy of Category 5. And this is the strongest hurricane to make landfall on the Florida Panhandle.
Winds of up to 172 kilometers per hour whipped up seas, pounded the coastline and destroyed ships as Typhoon Jebi struck Japan, bringing with it the country's latest bout of extreme weather.
Radio EcoShock.
There's a long shopping list of extreme weather and scary new science out there. It is strange times in Portugal, in the Florida Panhandle, in Wales, and even in Paul Beckwith's hometown of Ottawa, Canada. Did I mention the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and our record climate bonfire this year, our record carbon bonfire? But there's another huge climate story that is getting missed, and Paul has it. Our guest is climate scientist Paul Beckwith. He taught at Canadian universities, and these days he teaches the world through his YouTube videos and appearances on Radio EcoShock. Paul, welcome back to the show.
It's always a pleasure to be on your show, Alex.
You've done a lot of videos about the Arctic, Paul. I could call it your specialty. And honestly, when I got notification of two new videos on missing Arctic sea ice, I sighed and I wondered, well, so what is Paul on about now? I thought I'd kind of heard it all, you know?
Right.
And after 13 years of covering the climate beat, I'm pretty jaded about the possibilities. But I watched your two new videos and I was shocked again. And I'd like to build methodically towards understanding what I would call a new climate force that you're talking about that could shift life in this whole northern hemisphere and beyond that. So let's start at the start. What is the situation with Arctic sea ice in 2018, and how does it compare to previous years?
Well, we just had the minimum, sea ice minimum, about a month ago. Normally it happens on about September 15th, but it was later this year. There were two minimum, one on the 18th, I believe, and one on the 22nd or something like that. Anyway, it was about a week later than normal. It didn't set a new record. But the surprising thing now is that it doesn't really seem to be forming back that quickly. In fact, in the central Arctic basin, it's still been declining. It's very, very thin. It's very fractured. It's very broken up. And it's behaving quite differently than it has in the past. So, I expect to see it all gone by 2022. When September, in the next few years, we'll have a completely open Arctic Ocean.
Well, you've predicted the Blue Ocean event before and been wrong about the timing. But you know what, Paul? I don't really think the time matters because scientists agree that pretty soon we will see an open Arctic Ocean. Maybe there'd be a couple of small patches of ice channels around the Canadian archipelago, but it's going to happen. So what we need to know now, what are the main causes of disappearing sea ice in the Arctic?
Well, it's being hit from all sides, so to speak. The atmosphere is extremely warm. In fact, the next week or so in the Arctic is going to be 15 to 20 degrees Celsius warmer than normal. That's the air temperatures we're talking about. So the ice is not forming quickly on the surface. The ocean water temperature is also quite warm. When the ice melts in the summer, there's a lens, if you like, of cold, fresh water, the meltwater from the ice just underneath, and it goes down to, about 40, 50 meters, something like that, in places. And underneath that, the ocean water is actually warmer. It's salty and warm, so the saltiness makes it heavier than the colder freshwater lens. But there's enough heat in that water underneath to basically take out the whole ice. So if there's enough mixing of the water, enough wave action, then that can be a big feedback to take out the ice. There's also lots of incursions of warmer water into the Arctic Ocean, both through the Bering Strait from the Pacific Ocean and through the Fram Strait and through the from the Atlantic Ocean in the northward part. So there's this salty, warm ocean water coming into the Arctic Ocean underneath the surface on both sides. So there's a lot of feedbacks going on here to rapidly accelerate the ice loss.
Yeah, people keep sending me shots of what's happening with those warm Arctic waters coming in, especially through the Bering Strait. People, Sam Carana will post photographs. I've seen them from Robert Scribbler, who's doing a video blog now about the climate change. Robert Scribbler's blog, his real name is Robert Fanny. We've had him on Radio EcoShock. But also, scientists are pointing these things out. And when you look at those maps and you see that red or even purple heat going up through the Bering Strait right into the Arctic Sea, you go, what is happening? Why is it being pushed in?
Yes, I think the biggest factor is that the circulation patterns have completely changed, both in the atmosphere, which is the jet streams mostly we're talking about, and also in the ocean, the ocean current. So the Arctic is much, much warmer because it's darker. It's a darker place, having lost tremendous amounts of sea ice, which is highly reflective, and also snow cover over the land. Over Siberia, northern Canada, et cetera, the snow cover, mostly in the spring, is much reduced. So these trends are happening. So the jet streams are becoming so wavy that the ridges of the waves are going right up into the far Arctic and the troughs are going very, very far south. So this is a very strong feedback because, you know, moving warm air into the Arctic, of course, is going to warm it. But by the same token, you know, large excursions of cold air from the Arctic moving southward are then displaced in the Arctic by warmer air as well. So all of these things are contributing to greatly warming the Arctic. So we're heading to no sea ice, and that's going to be, you know, a completely different situation for us.
Yeah, and that's partly because, as you explained in your two new videos, of the distance that winds can now blow over open sea rather than over the sea ice. But why does that make a difference?
Yes, the wave height, ocean wave height, is dependent on a number of factors. It's dependent on basically the wind speed, and there's friction. You know, as the winds blow over the surface of the water, there's friction, and it starts the water moving. So the speed of the winds is very important. The duration, so how long the winds are blowing over the water, you know, the longer they go for, the more they can get the water moving. And also the distance over which they blow, which is the fetch, which is what you were just talking about. So with less and less sea ice, more and more open water, the wave heights can build up much, much higher than they would if the ice was still there. And this wave action does a number of different things. It causes lots of coastal erosion. And when there's coastal erosion, there's organic material that is released. Often you get coastlines kind of collapsing and exposing the organic matter, which can then break down and produce the methane. So, you know, lots of these coastlines are essentially permafrost, which has been thawed by contact with the ocean water. And yeah, there's also lots of mixing of water with depth. So when the waves build up, then there's more vertical mixing. And the problem is that can bring up the heat that's in the water, that's in the saltier, warmer water down below. And that mixing will then bring up more heat. And all of these things combine to removing more and more sea ice. So the jet streams will change completely, I think, when there's no sea ice left.
So you talked about this vast pod of relatively warmer water below what looks to me like the Western Arctic Ocean. Is there a name for that? Why is it there?
Okay, so this is fairly recent research. We're talking about a paper that's described this in detail that came out just within the last few months. And I don't know of a name that is coined for it, but basically, the origin of this water is thought to be incursions of water from the North Atlantic or from the Bering Strait. But the water is very, very salty, but it's warmer. So, you know, warmer water floats on top of colder water, right? It's lighter, but the salt in the water makes it heavier. So these two factors determine the density of the water. And it turns out that this warmer water, because it's so salty, is actually less buoyant than the fresh, cold water, which comes off the melt of the sea ice.
So are you saying that this could And are these scientists saying that this could be a new source of warmth into the Arctic coming up from under the ocean that we hadn't really expected?
Yes, this is fairly new research, as I said, and it wasn't really, I think the number of scientists knew that there was, the water was warmer, you know, they knew the structure, the bathymetry of the Arctic, but they didn't realize how much heat there was actually in this water underneath. And the heat content has significantly increased in the last few decades. I think that was the biggest surprise, that how quickly that water, how much warmer that water is getting. Now, Peter Wadhams, in the past, you probably remember, he was talking about the water going over the eastern Siberian Arctic shelf. And from measurements that he and others took in the Arctic, they found that the water 50 meters down on the continental shelf was anywhere from, you know, up 5 degrees Celsius warmer than normal. And recently I've heard it's up to 7 degrees warmer than normal. Of course, this can thaw out the marine sediment, and, you know, the heat can go down, and we have to worry about the methane class rates. And then he wrote that paper a few years ago about the possibility of a 50 gigaton release of methane. A big burst of methane from the continental shelf was a concern.
Yeah, well, we're going to need a name, Paul, for this theory of a possible new force of warming coming up from the ocean bottom, let's say, or from deeper in the ocean. If it doesn't have a name yet, somebody's going to have to give it one, because it sounds like something that we'll all have to learn about.
Yeah, I mean, it's very significant. I mean, we do know that, you know, when we talk about global warming or climate change, we mostly talk about effects, you know, on the continents, right? The direct effects to us. But the oceans are taking up, what, 93% or something of the heat. So, you know, global warming is really, you know, global ocean temperature increase. And of course, that affects everything, you know, most notably, you know, the hurricanes that we've been seeing lately and things like that.
That's what I want to talk to you about next. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Paul Beckwith, the climate scientist who tells all in a series of YouTube videos that are sort of part classroom and part horror as he explains the coming climate shift.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
We can cycle back to more Arctic news later, but let's get closer to home, much closer to your home. You survived the blitz of tornadoes in Ottawa, Canada. What happened?
Yeah, it was quite amazing. So on September 21st, it was 28.5 degrees Celsius with extremely high humidity. I think it was 70% or even higher during the day on that Friday, September 21st. And a cold front came through, a very, very extreme cold front. So, and it was moving fast, about 80 kilometers an hour. So that clash of cold, dry air with the warm, humid air in Ottawa, warm, humid air is lighter. It was pushed upwards, and it generated all of these supercell storms along the cold front. And the jet streams were in a location such that you would start getting rotation. So all the ingredients were there for the generation of these tornadoes. So we actually had an EF3 come through the northwest part of Ottawa and into Gatineau. And we also had an EF2 touch down in South Ottawa and move along for about 8 kilometers or so. There was another tornado in Ontario in Calabogie from that storm, and there were three in northern Quebec. So this was very unusual for Ottawa, especially, you know, in September. Previous tornadoes have been generally in June, July, August, that sort of thing. But coming this far north and so late in the year is exceptional. Then the week after, the city of Detroit was impacted by three tornadoes that went within city limits. And then a week after that, there was a tornado swarm in Pennsylvania. I think there were over 20 tornado warnings, and there were about 13 or 14 tornadoes that touched down in Pennsylvania that day. So basically, Tornado Alley is becoming very quiet in the U.S., and tornadoes seem to be becoming more frequent and more prevalent north of Tornado Alley, up into Canada even.
Yeah, this is weird because, you know, I grew up in southern Ontario, three different places in southern Ontario. Never heard of a tornado. There was one that hit Sarnia, I remember. I don't remember it, but I remember hearing about it in 1953, a big one. And there was a horror in Barrie, Ontario in 1985. But in general, we never worried about tornadoes. We thought about the atomic bomb might hit from the Soviet Union, but not tornadoes. So this is a new regime. And I want to tell listeners, too, we have Breaking Science just published October 17th in Nature's NPJ Climate and Atmospheric Science Journal. Scientists Vittorio A. Gensini and Harold E. Brooks show that America's terrifying Tornado Alley, as Paul says, appears to be shifting to the east. They find, quote, negative tendencies of tornado occurrence have been noted in portions of the central and southern Great Plains, while robust positive trends have been documented in portions of the Midwest and Southeast United States. Wow, that's going to come as a shock to millions of people who thought tornadoes were for other people.
Yes. Also, you know, as bad as they were in Tornado Alley, you know, it's mostly grasslands. There's very few trees and population densities are very, very low. So where these tornadoes are moving to, there's forested areas that are very densely populated. This is a significant shift.
Yeah, those trees hit people's houses and they hit people's cars and they kill people. We had more deaths than I would have expected.
Yes. I mean, it was amazing in Ottawa that there weren't any deaths from the EF3 and EF2. There were a few deaths in other locations because there were also downbursts and things that were occurring along the storm front.
All right. So the big killer, though, and the big news has been the wildly destructive Hurricane Michael hitting the Florida Panhandle on October 10th, 2018. And only a few days before, Michael was just a tropical disturbance down south of the Yucatan. It was pretty unnerving for one of the strongest hurricanes in U.S. history to be able to wind up like that in just a few days. How could that happen so fast?
Yes, Michael kind of really snuck up on people. There was a lot of discussion and talk when the previous hurricane, Florence, was coming through and hit the Carolinas. It was a long-duration tornado over the land, similar to Hurricane Harvey the previous year, which meandered around Texas, dropping as much as 5 feet of rain. So there was a lot more news and talk about Hurricane Florence. And then Michael formed, as you said, just a weak disturbance south of the Gulf of Mexico toward in the Caribbean region. And, you know, it kind of snuck up. It crossed the Gulf of Mexico where the water was extremely warm and it gained energy a lot faster than people expected. And when it came ashore in the panhandle of Florida, it was 155 mile an hour winds, which is just 1 mile an hour short of being a category 5. And of course the damage was tremendous, including damage to the Tyndall Air Force Base. They have the F-22 Raptors at that base. I think there's about 50 odd or more of these planes, each one worth about $330 million U.S., and they flew out about 30 or so elsewhere before the storm, but there were about 20 or so that were in the hangars, and a lot of the hangars lost their roofs, and there was damage to these very expensive planes, and you can see the outline of these planes through the holes in the roofs of the hangars.
So one of the driving forces of this is the warming oceans, which you just talked about, the real story of our carbon emissions, that we're heating up the oceans, and one of the side effects of that is going to be fast-moving, really strong storms.
Yes, the ocean, anytime the water temperature is above 26.5 degrees Celsius, then the storm can gain energy over that type of water. So, you know, the water is significantly warmer than that in many locations. So the storms just gain tremendous amounts of energy. And what was surprising, too, about Michael is that Michael, it maintained its strength for a long distance over the land. One of the reasons being that, you know, when you get all the water, all the rainfall falling on warm land, then a lot of that rain can then be evaporated and go back up and provide more energy to maintain the strength of the hurricane as it's crossing the land. So there's actually a region where the hurricane lost strength as it was moving ashore over the Florida Panhandle, and then it didn't just continue to lose strength. It actually, there was a time period where it actually maintained and even slightly gained strength as it was moving across. And I've heard this phenomena or talked about it being sort of a brown ocean event, if you like. You know, to the hurricane's perspective, the very wet, hot land and the evaporation can fuel the storm, almost like the ocean does. But it's over the land. It's water on the land that does that. And of course, last year we had, you know, was a horrible hurricane year. We had, I mean, Florida got off lightly when Irma came across, because Irma was heading for Miami and Palm Beach, and it was looking to go right up the eastern coast of Florida. This was 12 hours before it ended up hitting Florida. It veered at the last minute, so to speak, came across the Everglades, and, you know, it was a bad storm, but it would have been $1 trillion perhaps of damages if it had raised Miami and Palm Beach and, you know, that the east coast of Florida. And of course, Maria, you know, did a huge devastation on Puerto Rico. So these storms are becoming much worse. And of course, the storm surge is very large. And when you add the storm surge on top of very, very high tides, king tides, but also on top of sea level rise, then, you know, it's just a grief, right, for people living on the coast.
Well, one of the statistics that comes up on my SoundCloud page, where I put all the shows as well as in my blog, is that there were 21 listeners last week in Pittsboro, North Carolina, which surprised me. But we also have listeners in Dallas, Texas, another couple dozen listeners there. And of course, we have stations throughout the South and the Northeast. And I'm thinking that from what you're telling me, between this idea that the tornadoes are moving east and that we're going to have more extreme storms from a hotter Gulf of Mexico and a hotter Atlantic, our listeners in the Southeast United States and the Eastern Seaboard better get ready for more flooding and more terrible weather.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the real risk when we lose Arctic sea ice is that Greenland's sitting up there, it'll be the only cold spot left. And of course, the melt rates on Greenland will notch up very, very quickly as the whole Arctic is much, much warmer. And not only that, but the jet streams, which circle around roughly the center of cold in the Arctic, if you like, which is right now, it's just south of the North Pole. It's not the North Pole. It's shifted southward towards Greenland because Greenland goes quite far south. But with no sea ice, the center of Greenland is at 73 degrees north latitude. So that's where I would expect the jet stream center of rotation to be, about that cold spot, about the cold center of Greenland. So we're going to see, not just is the jet stream becoming wavier and slower, but its center of rotation, I think, is going to shift. So that's going to be very significant to our ability to grow food and supply food for the world to eat in a significant enough quantity. Things are very, very serious. All aspects of our society is going to change from this abrupt climate change.
Getting back to strange storms, Spain and Portugal hardly ever see an actual hurricane, and I think one struck in the 1800s. But on Saturday, October 14th, Hurricane Leslie struck Portugal with winds of 109 miles per hour or 175 kilometers an hour. Things are getting very unpredictable. Why would an Atlantic hurricane curl back towards Portugal and Spain? That's really bizarre.
Yeah, Leslie was another amazing storm, Hurricane Leslie. It was formed, I think, about 3 weeks, or like the storm lasted about 21 days or so. So it was meandering around the Atlantic, you know, doing loops and stuff like that before it then, you know, reached a latitude where the prevailing winds were to the east. It just went right across, clear across, and impacted Portugal, as you said. You probably remember Hurricane Ophelia last year, which hit Ireland, And Ireland had a tropical storm, I believe, this year that also impacted it. It wasn't quite a hurricane, but it was a tropical storm. And I remember a few years ago, there was a hurricane, or maybe it was downgraded to a tropical storm, that hit Brazil, which is, again, very, very unusual. So with these jet streams, it's very important to remember that the extreme weather events, and that includes hurricanes, tornadoes, everything else, torrential rains, they're increasing in frequency in general. They're increasing in severity. They're increasing in duration. And they're also hitting regions of the world that never had them before.
Yeah, on October 16th, the storm called Callum, maybe that's the one you're referring to, flooded hundreds of homes across Wales. It was billed as the worst flooding in 30 years. You know, I'm wondering, not long ago, Dr. James Hansen, the former chief scientist at NASA, he warned that storms stronger than any seen in our past records could blow up out of the Atlantic. What was he talking about, and does it relate to what we've just been talking about today?
James Hansen, he wrote the classic book,
Storms of Our Grandchildren.
Storms of Our Grandchildren, yes, a few years ago now. And what he was talking about mostly was the contrast between warm and cold air and the very, very warm oceans, and with the idea of these massive storms and high winds with a jet stream shift over the Atlantic, such that you could build up these enormous swells that would be heading, for example, to hitting areas like Bermuda and some of the islands southwest of Bermuda, like these massive, with wave trains of 30 meters height type of thing.
Oh my God.
Because he was looking at boulders and things that had been actually moved far inland on some of these islands, the idea being that they were picked up from the seafloor and tossed up 30 meters above present sea level. You know, so these type of massive storms, he wasn't really focusing too much on the jet stream. I'm a bit surprised. I mean, Hansen's done great work, of course. He still continues to it. And the kids' lawsuit against the U.S. government is proceeding.
It is?
Yes. But one thing that is surprising is that he hasn't really talked too much about jet streams and like the rapidly warming Arctic and the impact on jet streams and extreme weather events from that sort of thing. You know, I haven't heard him talking too much about methane and some of the other feedback. This is the thing about the IPCC 1.5 report.
Hold on. That's what I want to get to in my very next segment.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. My guest is Canadian climate scientist Paul Beckwith. We are trying to cover a world in climate trouble, and Paul has moved right on to the very next thing I wanted to ask him about, this latest report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Their final report on 1.5 degrees of warming found another magical 10 or 15 years of fine fossil fuel living before we really have to change. And, well, Paul, you found a few problems with this report, didn't you?
Yes, I think one of the most significant things is that the baseline used in this report is 1850. 1900, whereas when these reports and the IPCC was first talking about the 2 degrees Celsius guardrail that we have to stay within, and then later that became, in Paris, the 1.5 degree Celsius number came out and was pushed as being, you know, a target. If you look back in the history, these temperatures were relative to 1750, the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, being defined as 1750. So the problem is that the temperature, global average temperature, has warmed roughly 0.2 to 0.3 degrees Celsius between 1750 and the average between 1850 and 1900. So we've gone up 1 degree relative to that 1850 to 1900 average, but that's really in effect 1.2 or 1.3 degrees higher than the 1750 pre-industrial number. So, you know, it's a matter of changing baselines. We really, I don't understand why this is being done, apart from shows things are better than they really are. So that's one factor. But I guess the key thing is that, like, the report is great, you know, don't get me wrong, but it's painting too rosy a picture. It's not pointing out the harsh reality of what actually exists with climate change. It doesn't talk enough about the Arctic impacts on jet streams. It doesn't talk enough about feedback, because there's a whole plethora of feedback which can easily take us higher. And also, the fact is that we're warming right now, the present climate system, we're warming about 0.25 degrees Celsius per decade. So the report is saying, well, yes, if we're at 1, then in 20 years we'll be at 1.5, and then in 40 years we'd be at 2. But if we're actually already 1.25 or 1.3 above using the 1750 baseline, then, you know, 10 years we're going to be pushed above 1.5. In 3 decades we'd be at 2, and that's without any acceleration in the warming, which we know. You know, you can't assume there won't be acceleration in the warming. We're seeing it real time. So those are some key factors. Also, you know, according to Peter Wadhams, if we had that methane burst from the Eastern Siberian Arctic Shelf, it would raise global temperatures about 0.6 degrees in just a few years. So, you know, we'd be rocketing well above 1.5 if we had that, you know, a significant methane burst, for example, from the Eastern Siberian Arctic Shelf.
The thing that also really puzzles me is Dr. Hansen started talking about warming that's in the pipeline, but that is hidden or masked due to our pollution, the global dimming factor. But now I'm not hearing anything about it. So if we've already gone up 1.1 or 1.3 degrees from 1750, from pre-industrial times, what about the 1 degree or so that's there already in the atmosphere just waiting to happen as soon as we clean up our pollution? And why aren't people talking about that?
Yes, I mean, that number is still being hotly contested as to how large it is. I've seen papers where they talk about the global dimming factor. So this is if you stop all fossil fuel burning, right? The aerosols come out of the sky quickly, and then so you get more sunlight hitting the ground. It's not reflected by the aerosols from the particulates from burning coal and oil, et cetera. So I've seen that the temperature would rise. The number I've seen is anywhere from 0.5 degrees, half a degree, up to 5 degrees, actually. So I don't, you know, I think it's closer. You mentioned a degree or something. I think it's, yeah, I think it's towards the lower end of that range, but we don't really know exactly. And also, you know, if global dimming aside, I mean, if we cut off fossil fuel emissions, carbon, the CO2 stays in the atmosphere for a long time. So we're still going to be having warming, this 0.25 degree warming. So we actually have to reduce the CO2 level in the atmosphere. Slashing emissions just brings it down, but we also have to actively remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere/ocean system in order to avoid catastrophic ocean acidification, and also to bring us down to a more stable, healthy climate. You know, if we can talk about such a thing, it seems far off, but I mean, we have to try these things. So carbon dioxide removal is very, very important. And also, you know, once we lose Arctic sea ice, the warming in the Arctic will greatly accelerate. And, you know, we have huge problems, as we've talked about. So, you know, this is why, you know, I think we absolutely have to do solar radiation management as well to try to keep the Arctic cooler.
Well, okay. Here's another headline from The New Scientist, October 16th. Bill Gates leads global call to accept realities of a warming planet. And this article just made me angry. It includes plenty of quotes from an official at the World Bank saying we need to prepare for the coming climate mess. And this is from the same World Bank that until a couple of years ago funded coal plants all over the world. This is from the same Bill Gates who kept quiet about global warming when he was in a position to call for big changes and pay for some of them. And now they sort of admit the climate game is lost, so we should dig in and adapt to the coming drought and failing agriculture and millions of heat deaths. And they're right, but the timing turns my stomach. We knew this would happen, Paul. First, they make it happen. Then they deny it's happening. Then they tell us to get used to it. You saw that coming, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's absurd. There's not a lot of hope on the political front that, like, I guess the pain is not severe enough for them to, they're going to go from this, well, climate change isn't a problem, you know, short term, to, well, that's it, we're finished, there's nothing we can do, right? I mean, there's lots of places in between those two extremes. I don't know if you're aware, but just a few days ago, the Green Party and the NDP in Canada's, the federal government parties, they got the Liberals to agree to have an emergency session in Parliament on the report, on the IPCC 1.5 report. So Monday night, they started at about 6:30 p.m. debating in the House of Parliament in Ottawa for, you know, Canada's federal government about the climate emergency. And they finished up about midnight or so. They went about 5.5 hours of debating. I'm sure there's a recording of it all. I watched a few hours of it on closed circuit TV. So it's a start. I mean, the Conservative Party, we've got a whole political party that doesn't really want to take any action on climate change. They don't think it's serious. And this is around the world, which, you know, the right wing governments are, not putting policies in for climate change. And the problem is it's kind of a vicious feedback, because as climate change accelerates and worsens, there's more and more people that are displaced from their homelands. And these people have to go somewhere, either within cities, within the country that they're in, or they have to cross borders. And guess whose borders they cross? They go into countries with progressive governments. And there may be, you know, lots of people migrating into these countries. There's a nationalistic or populist backlash in those countries. And the progressive governments get tossed out, replaced by right-wing governments, which immediately kill any climate cap and trade or carbon fee and dividend or any price on carbon. They turf it out. So we're getting this political shift to right-wing governments that will deny climate change. So this is a huge human feedback, if you like, which I don't know the solution to, apart from educating more and more people that we need to have a price on carbon, you know, whatever the government in power is.
Well, you just described what is happening in many countries of the world, and it's pretty pathetic. But I have to say, too, that in Canada, where Prime Minister Trudeau sounded very progressive on climate change when he was wanting to get elected, but has actually purchased the Trans Mountain Pipeline project to get dirty tar sands oil out to the Vancouver coast, where it will be shipped from the port of Vancouver and endanger the whole coast with super tankers, like almost a super tanker a day. It's unbelievable. And then the progressive climate-friendly alliance of the NDP and green governments in the province of British Columbia have just announced a gigantic, possibly one of the world's largest export shipments for liquefied natural gas from the North Port in British Columbia. So it's even the good guys are doing the worst. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's a $40 billion project, the liquefied natural gas project. I mean, it boils down to, you know, governments are, you know, they may talk a good story, but their actions are what is important. And their actions, they're still subsidizing fossil fuel companies. And yeah, it's very discouraging in Canada, because we knew that the Conservatives wouldn't have climate plans. We thought that the Liberals would, and we've seen what happened. I mean, the problem is the asymmetry. It seems to take progressive governments years and years and years to actually put in a price on carbon. And by that time, They're then quickly voted out and replaced by another government, which will kill those years and years and years of planning and work in a day or so. I mean, it's very simple to put a fee on carbon, a fee and dividend. You could just have an extra line on the income tax form. It could have been implemented within a month of the Liberal government being elected. So we could have had it, we could have been having it for 3 years already almost in Canada. Instead of that, it's going to come in by 2019. And then, no, who knows what's going to happen with the Liberals. A poll recently showed that if the election was today, the Conservatives would get a majority. So,
Paul, we won't be worried about all this stuff because we've got plenty of legalized pot now in Canada. So that's that. We can all get stoned as the climate goes to heck.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. My guest is climate scientist Paul Beckwith. And listeners, if you're thinking about new stories of solar energy and wind farms opening, and I applaud those and I cover them on this show, but let's not forget what is really happening. Here's a story from the business paper Bloomberg News, published October 12th. The world is pumping out more oil and other petroleum liquids than ever before. Global supply rose to 100.3 million barrels a day in the third quarter, the International Energy Agency said Friday in its monthly report. Output includes crude oil, natural gas, liquids, biofuels, and refinery processing gains. So here we are. The carbon bonfire has hit another new record, over 100 million barrels a day, at a time when, 10 years ago, I thought it would be slowly creeping downward and we'd be replacing it with other things. It's not happening.
Yeah, I mean, crossing that 100 million barrels a day, I remember, I mean, the number that sticks in my mind is 82 or 84 million barrels a day, and that's only from about a decade ago or so. So, I mean, we're just heading more quickly in the wrong direction with this. And, you know, people think, okay, well, natural gas is cleaner burning, which it is. You know, remember we talked about the phrases where natural gas would be a bridge fuel to get off oil, to transition to renewables. But the problem is this bridge fuel has very high leak rates from pipe and transport and stuff, which make it just as bad as coal, unfortunately. And, you know, methane, of course, is a very – natural gas is 90% methane, and methane is a very potent greenhouse gas, as we know.
And here's the real shocker. As we burn more and more fossil fuels, carbon dioxide in the atmosphere broke another record in 2018. We went over 411 parts per million in May of this year, according to the observatory in Hawaii. And the article at Yale Environment 360 adds this hair-raising statement. In addition, scientists found that the rate of CO2 increase is accelerating from an average of 1.6 parts per million per year in the 1980s, 1.5 million parts per year in the 1990s, to 2.2 million parts per year during the last decade. Paul, what does that increase on our increase mean other than exponential climate change?
Well, this is the key number, right? The level of CO2 in the atmosphere. So we're about close to 410 parts per million. And as you've said, the average rise has been 2.2 parts per million over the last decade. We've had some years that have been as high as 3 parts per million. Put this in relative terms to the fastest rises that we have seen in the paleo record, so in the Earth's deep history, even time periods when the CO2 is very rapidly rising in the past, it's only rising at rates something like 0.2 parts per million per year. So we're at least 10 to 15 times faster now in the change of CO2 in the atmosphere than we have been at any other point in Earth's history, from the best we can tell from paleo proxies and things. So you can look at just about any climate parameter, whether it be, you know, rise in methane, rise in global average temperature, you know, rise in sea level. You can look at any of these metrics and, you know, we're near the top end in the history of the planet. not there yet with sea level rise. There's a lag with sea level rise, but there's been periods in Earth history where the average sea level rise has been about 5 centimeters a year for 50 or 100 years. That would be 5 meters in a century sort of thing. And I expect that we'll be exceeding those sort of rates, especially when we lose Arctic sea ice and Greenland calving rates get larger and larger. I am working right now on a series of videos on all the climate feedbacks, and also I'm going to look at the melt rates from Greenland and Antarctica and identify the regions that are most concerning for rapid sea level rise.
And are there other new stories or new science that have caught your attention that you want to tell us about?
Well, I love to read, books.
Books?
books.
I remember those.
Devices. And there's a couple of great books. Well, one in particular I'm reading, I finished, and the author is Laurent Gonzalez. The book is called Deep Survival, Who Lives, Who Dies, and Why. And it's a fascinating book that delves into, the human emotions and intellect and psychology with loads of examples of, people that have survived the most horrendous conditions, being like breaking a leg and being stranded on a mountain, or being the only survivor of a plane crash in the Amazon, in the Peruvian jungle, and walking through the jungle and, being found like a few weeks later, a 12-year-old or a 14-year-old girl. Whereas, a dozen people survived the plane crash in the wreckage, and they were all dead when they were found about 2 weeks later. And they had all kinds of supplies. They could have fires, they had food, they had water, they had everything, but they, 12 adults died in the space of a couple of weeks, whereas this 12 or 14-year-old girl, was on her own, no supplies, nothing, in the deepest jungle, and basically walked out and survived. So what is it that allows some people to be able to do this? Like, it's not just fluke. There's lots of patterns. And you're wondering, well, what does this have to do with what we're talking about? But climate change really attacks the psyche, right? It attacks the emotions. It makes people, think, well, what do we do? I mean, what can I do? Nothing. Throw up your hand, sort of ignore it or give up. So there's a lot of good tips in this book. And the author's also written another book called Surviving Survival. And it's how to, people that often survive with extreme odds, they have problems later on. They have all this guilt about why did they survive and nobody else did, sort of thing. So I'm reading those sort of things. I'm finding that they're very useful. There's lots of lessons to be learned and lots of things in those books that can help us all as we go through this abrupt climate change situation.
Yeah, I find that I can read a dozen climate stories, and then I'll run into some little detail. It might be about disappearing turtles, or it might be just some statement. Well, here's one here. This is a quote from Nassim Nicholas Taleb, and he wrote it in his book Fooled by Randomness, and it says, "It does not matter how frequently something succeeds if failure is too costly to bear." And I mean, that's where we're at now with industrial civilization. We're succeeding. Hey, everything's going great. If I want to fly to Peru, I can do it. No problem. There's lots of food on the shelves. And that can go on for a while. But failure, climate failure, is too costly to bear.
Did he write The Black Swan?
Yes. Yes, he did.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of really good books on these sort of topics that can sort of help people come to grips with how to deal with what's happening.
Well, I hope so, because we all need it. We all have our coping mechanisms. And, another listener sort of chastised me for saying, well, that's great, Alex. You do these terrible radio shows, and then you talk about going out to your garden and digging up your potatoes, feeling self-satisfied. But no, I have to have these potatoes to feel like I can keep on making radio. This is what powers me, is just the idea that at least I'm connecting with something natural and I'm doing something to survive. And we all have to develop our mechanisms for handling this very frightening news.
Yes. I mean, you've also, you know, you've had a lot to deal with those fires in BC, right? And the smoke, you know, some of them were actually quite close to you, from what I understand.
Well, we had one right just up the hill. I was sitting on my front porch, and I saw this big burl of smoke going up, and then I actually saw the fire on the ridge of the hill over our town. It only has to burn down that one little ridge, and here it is on our doorstep. Yeah, I was freaked out. We had some bags packed. We were starting to put stuff in the truck to get out of here, but three planes showed up out of nowhere and totally dumped it, and I think they only did it because there was a natural gas line runs right past our town, and they didn't want that to blow up. So we got super air power for a tiny little village all of a sudden because we were right on a critical spot.
Right. So you didn't think of going out to the fire and roasting marshmallows or something, eh?
I don't even like marshmallows, but secondly, no. If there's going to be a gas line involved, I've occasionally calculated how far the fireball would reach, and I don't think it would reach our house. We'd lose the windows, but... Yeah, so there's no sense dwelling on all that. There's a thousand ways to die.
Yeah, exactly. I mean the tornadoes that came through Ottawa that night, I mean, it was just a friend of mine was driving, and he was a few minutes away from Dunrobin, and the sky was really dark. And he drove into Dunrobin, which is just west of Ottawa, and that town was pretty much leveled by the EF3. And he said it was just like a war zone. Like he said, people were walking around in shock, and it was really weird to drive along the road because there was about 6 inches of pine needles covering the road. So, you know, you're driving along, you know, over these pine needles on the road and, you know, dodging trees and branches and stuff. I mean, and yeah, it's just amazing that nobody was killed in that town. I mean, people went down into their basements. There was tornado warnings in advance, so people took them seriously and went down into their basements. So yeah, we just don't, you know, life is pretty fragile, we realize, right, when these things happen.
There's going to be a whole genre of climate survival stories, and people will share them and maybe learn from them. I just want to get in one more thing here before I forget. Listeners, you can watch Paul Beckwith's two new videos that we started out talking about on the Arctic. And so what you do is you look for Profound Climate Mayhem with No Arctic Sea Ice and Part 2. So you can find those with a Google search on Paul Beckwith's YouTube channel or at his website at paulbeckwith.net. And I'll put links in my own show blog as well. They're easy to find. Just look for Profound Climate Mayhem, and I think they should pop up. Those two videos, extremely educational, extremely powerful, and as I said before, they, to me, suggest yet another force that could be coming out that is not anywhere near that IPCC report. Well, Paul, what are you trying to do with these continuous YouTube videos? You shoot a lot of them. Each one of them is contained with charts and facts. And why are you doing this?
Why am I doing this? I guess I can't think of anything better to do. I think it's a bit important to, it's funny because, you know, I've had hope for a long time that enough people would listen and other people would do similar things to me and we'd actually get strong action on climate change. But to have hope and to have your hopes dashed, it's pretty hard on the psyche. So, you know, it's in some cases, it's better not to have hope, but then not to feel we're not hopeless either, right? Those are the two extremes. I mean, you basically, you know, have compassion for other people, stay interested in, you know, what you're doing. You can only do your little bit, you know, and not think too much of the outcome. And just talk about what's happening. I break down the science. I try to join the dots and extend the science. And yeah, it's sort of my potato garden, if you like.
Well, you know the old saying, it's better to have hoped and lost than never to have hoped at all.
And there is an Environment Canada and climate change grant called the Climate Action Fund. And I actually put in a proposal to get some funding from them to duplicate what I do, but have what I do in parallel with all Canadian content line. So, you know, mostly have information from Canadian scientists, but talk about different Canadian cities and how they'll fare in climate change and, you know, how basically try to set up videos that can educate teachers, because teachers teaching high school, you know, the kids get very little climate change stuff. Even in geography classes and science classes, they get very little. And the teachers aren't up to date on the latest stuff. They're using textbooks that may be a decade old or something for teaching their classes. So some sort of series of videos that could be used to educate younger people about what's happening.
Well, the other thing I'd like to see, if there was infinite grant money for you, is to get translations running below your talk in your videos in Spanish, in German, in Chinese, in Hindi, so the people around the world can tune in to the climate science that you're delivering. That'd be a fantastic project.
Yes, that's a great idea. I mean, there are some people, you know, that have translated the odd video or taken transcripts from the video, you know, transcribed, you know, what I say into words and then translated into different languages. So there has been, you know, a couple of videos that have been done that way. But I need to get some sort of funding to do that on a regular basis with each video. That would be a great, great thing to do.
Pretty soon Google will do it for you, all using AI.
Yes, that's right. It's getting better. Well, AI will solve climate change, right?
Oh, of course it will.
AI the solution, it'll say, is get rid of the human, right?
Well, that's what, who was it? Stephen Hawking was warning us that would be the end result anyway. I've got to wrap it up there, Paul.
One last thing. The Boston, I think it's Boston Dynamics or something that has the sort of robot AI.
Yeah.
The four-legged, like a dog or horse or whatever that runs around robot. I saw a video a few days ago. This thing's running around a corner, and somebody had put a banana peel on the ground. It went flying over the banana peel. It was hilarious.
Oh, those AI beings, they can be so humorous and lovable.
Yes, there's hope for us yet against the AIs. Great.
I hope they'll keep us around. We've been talking with our climate science advisor, Paul Beckwith, and after teaching climate science at the University of Ottawa, where he still does research, Paul embarked on teaching the world through YouTube. And you will find lots of links in my blog for this show, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.org. But go straight to Paul's website at paulbeckwith.net. Paul, thank you again for visiting with us again this week.
Thanks a lot, Alex. It's been great.
You've cheered me up a little. I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
I'll just change this thing. I've got to change this thing. She's way too crazy, way too hot. Normal is what she's not. Change this thing. Yeah.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
Coming up next, you'll hear audio from an interrogation by Israeli border officers that Chicago resident Wala Atman was able to record when she was detained at Ben Gurion Airport. Afterwards, we'll speak with her about her ordeal. Stay tuned.
American citizenship doesn't valid for you in Israel because you're a Palestinian. But I'm an American.
Your American nationality doesn't valid for you in Israel.
Okay, but I do have the right to come the same way that I left. A U.S. citizen.
You don't have right. This is my country, not America.
Respect
this is my country, not America.
You want the right to enter?
I'm sorry?
Ma'am, okay, let's finish with the custom.
Well, can I talk to your superior?
I'm a superior.
There has to be someone above you.
I'm the superior.
You don't want to sign?
I didn't even look at it because so I'm trying to talk to you guys.
But we don't need to talk to you.
Difficult.
We don't want to talk to you.
I'm a citizen.
Fill the form. If you will not fill the form, you will not get your bags.
I want my bags.
So fill the form, please. We don't need to talk to you. Finish, fill the form.
You don't need to talk to me that way. I'm a U.S. citizen. No one talks to me that way.
But you can.
Why you care? Why you think that we care that you're a U.S. citizen?
You don't care about U.S. citizens?
No.
Really?
Yes, really.
We support you the most.
So?
You don't care about
them? No, this is my country. This is not the part of America. We are not another city of the United States, something like that. This is Israel.
Your
tax is coming to this airport.
Yes.
So don't pay taxes. Because we don't allow you to get inside, so don't pay taxes.
No.
So you please tell Mr. Trump that I need a raise. Maybe he will arrange me a raise if he's paying my salary.
Is that supposed to be funny or
yes?
something?
Yes. You think that you're funny?
No, I don't.
So, be quiet.
You should be quiet. You're not being nice.
You what?
Ma'am.
I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, and you're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. That is a little bit of audio that Chicago resident Wala Otman was able to secretly record during her interrogation by an Israeli officer at the Ben-Gurion airport when she recently attempted to travel to Palestine. Wala, thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast today to talk about that recording and what happened to you.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
So let's talk about what that recording actually tells us. The officer says clearly, "I will explain it for the 10th time. Your American citizenship isn't valid for you in Israel because you are a Palestinian." This is not shocking. This is tacit Israeli policy that entry into Ben-Gurion Airport is absolutely fine for U.S. citizens who are white and Jewish, of course, with the caveat that you're not a member of an organization that supports Palestinian rights, of course. But if you're of Palestinian descent, he says, your citizenship isn't valid. It's significant that you were able to secretly record this. For years and years, we've documented stories about people being interrogated and deported based on their perceived or actual ethnicity or religion. Even the U.S. State Department has a warning to travelers going to Tel Aviv that says that you might be subjected to racial profiling at the border. Wala, can you talk about who you are and where you were going and what happened to you when you tried to use your passport to enter Ben-Gurion Airport near Tel Aviv?
Sure. So I'll start by when I first landed in Tel Aviv. I stopped in Jordan, and then my flight to Tel Aviv was at around 11 p.m. And I remember being in Jordan in the lounge and making sure I was drinking a lot of espresso because I knew it was going to be a long night. I was traveling alone, which was the first time traveling alone anywhere. My family and I, we used to visit Palestine every summer when I was a child. So to me, it was a very new experience to be going there as an adult. But I do remember what my parents would go through whenever we would enter through Tel Aviv. So I landed in Tel Aviv around midnight, and when I first went up to the window to give them my passport and to hopefully enter, the man at the window told me, have you ever been here? I said, yes. He said, when? And I said, 13 years ago, which is true. I have not been back to Palestine in 13 years, just due to schooling and life. And he asked me a very strange question. He said, why are each of your bags almost 50 kilos, about 23 pounds? And I said, well, I have my clothes in there and my shoes and handbags. And he says, well, it's summertime. You don't need that many clothes. And I just thought that was very strange. Like, what is it any of your business what I'm packing? And then he told me to go and wait in an area. And this was kind of like a waiting area. It was closed off, but it was still kind of opened. And then a different officer called me to a room, and he asked me more questions about what I do for a living and about my family. And I was advised by my family not to make it seem like I have ties to family in Palestine, because Israeli officers do not, they're not very fond of anyone that has relationships with people in Palestine. And so I told him that I was there to explore Tel Aviv and eat some shawarma. You know, I just kept it very lighthearted.
Right.
And I told him that I am there to visit Jerusalem. And I even had a hotel booked for that same day, for that morning, once I would hopefully leave Tel Aviv. And I had a car rental and everything. And he told me, okay, go wait in the room. So a lot of this, you know, the waiting is to provoke us, you know, and to, you know, kind of get us riled up. So I knew it was, you know, a mental thing, and I had to be strong. And so they called me to the other side, which I knew, because I've heard from my family, that that's not the good side. That's where they're kind of tougher on you. And when I went inside, this time they closed the door, and it was a different officer. And he says, you're here. He's like, he said, where's your Palestinian passport? And I said, oh, here it is. And he said, oh, you didn't give it to him in the beginning, so you were hiding it? I said, no, how am I hiding it if I'm giving it to you right now? And he said, oh, okay, so you are a Palestinian. He said, it's illegal for you to be here. I said, why? I'm a U.S. citizen. And he said, you're here to visit your family in Ramallah. And I had to really try hard to keep a straight face, because I was there to visit my family. And I said, no, no, I don't really keep in touch with anybody. I'm just here to explore Tel Aviv, and I have a reservation in Jerusalem after that. And he said, okay, you want to lie? Go outside and wait some more. I'm like, okay. So as I was waiting, I was like, I have to figure out how to record these guys. And so I kind of started playing with my phone, and I tried to use the video camera. And every time I pressed the button and I put my phone in my pocket, when I would, you know, take it out again, I could see that the video had ended. So I said, okay, let me try now with the recorder, the voicemail app. And, you know, I pressed the button, I put it in my pocket for a little bit just to see if it worked. And when I took it out, I could see that it was still recording. I said, okay, let me try this. So I had my phone in my pocket with my finger on the button to record, so that as soon as they called me, I could record them. But I didn't do this yet. So he brought me back inside after having me wait, and he told me, who's this? And he pointed at his computer, and it was a black and white fuzzy picture, but I could tell that it was me. I was probably about 5 years old, and I said, that's me. And he said, oh, you are a Palestinian, and you lived here. I said, no, I didn't. I came here with my family every summer, but I never lived here. He said, no, you're lying. You did live here. And, you know, he kept repeating himself, and I kept repeating myself. And he said, okay, go outside again. So it was just back and forth. And it was, you know, the middle of the night. And then a different officer called me. This time he didn't even call me to the room. He kind of, you know, summoned me. And, you know, other people were watching, which is already humiliating. And he was even dressed differently. He kind of looked like he was, you know, the main guy. And he looked down at me and he said, your entry to Tel Aviv has been denied. And I said, why? He said, because you're a Palestinian. I said, no, I'm a U.S. citizen. He's like, you're a Palestinian and you are not entering Tel Aviv. And that's when, you know, I was like, okay, I need to get this recorded. They had me sit down again, and I was ready to go with my recording, and they brought me into the room so that I can sign off on customs for my luggage. And then the entire time that I was in the room, that's the recording that you heard. And I kept repeating over and over again, I'm a U.S. citizen, I'm a U.S. citizen, because I wanted him to be very clear that he didn't care that I was a U.S. citizen. And he didn't, and he said it. And I even asked him, you know, in a separate question, I said, you don't care about U.S. citizens? He said, no. And I was shocked. And just, you know, the things that he said were very, you know, surprising, that because I knew I was recording, it was just, you know, I thought people were going to be shocked by it. And even when I listened to the recording again, I'm still shocked, because the U.S. is the biggest supporter of Israel. Even towards the end, I told him that my taxes pay for this airport, you know. And he said, okay, don't pay taxes, you know, and he was kind of trying to be funny and made a remark about telling President Trump to give him a raise, since America paid for his salary. And, you know, I told him, do you think that's funny or something? And he said, no. So be, you know, and he said, do you think you're funny? I said, no. And he told me to be quiet, and I told him, you should be quiet. You're not being nice. And that's when I had to turn off the recording, because he took out his handcuffs and was threatening to arrest me for talking back, because they were trying to provoke me. And in the end, he got riled up, because I knew I had to kind of, you know, maintain composure and, you know, not let them see that I was being bothered. So I was, you know, very calm for the most part. And so that was the end of the recording, but that wasn't the end of the detainment.
Right. When you say that he wasn't being nice, he cannot believe that a Palestinian woman would dare talk to him like that. Tell us about how it felt during this process. What was going through your mind at those moments?
You know, I was very upset inside, and I just kept, you know, telling myself, don't show them that you're upset. I mean, even as I was waiting, I would kind of, you know, just have a smirk on my face so that it could kind of seem like I was totally unbothered. I felt humiliated, and I felt like I was being mistreated. And, you know, I'm like, I feel like I need a witness. I need, you know, access to, you know, someone in America. And even at this time, my father was on the phone with the U.S. Embassy and telling him what was happening, and they told him that there wasn't really anything that they could do about it. So I was very upset, and, you know, felt like my blood was boiling on the inside, but I also knew that it wasn't over and that I wasn't going to give up. But I knew that I kind of had to, you know, look cool, calm, and collected just until I got back, or just got out of Tel Aviv somehow.
Well, and this is in the recording, he says, you don't have rights, this is my country. For you, what did that phrase mean? And tell us a little bit about your family's roots.
I wanted to laugh in his face when he said that, because it is definitely not his country. It is my country. It is my family's country. And so my mother's family is originally from Yaffa, or Jaffa, and my great-grandfather used to own acres and acres of land in Yaffa and Tel Aviv, because they are very close to each other. And he was actually a big producer of so many different crops, and Yaffa is known for their oranges, and he would outsource oranges and other produce to other countries from how much he was able to produce. And my family says, and I'm not so sure, you know, how true this is, but they say that part of Ben Gurion Airport is built on my great grandfather's land. So while I was in that detention center, I was just kind of thinking how ironic it was, like, well, kind of like I'm in my grandpa's home, but not really. So it was just very ironic for me, like, for him to say that it's his land when we might possibly be on my grandfather, my great-grandfather's land. So it was just ridiculous to hear him say that.
How long were you in detention?
I was detained for about 8 hours. I was there from midnight until about 8:45 a.m.
And when you were released, what happened? Were you able to enter Palestine? Did they just say, okay, you can go in, or were you deported?
Well, after the recording, let me just tell you kind of what happened from the recording until I exited the airport. So the recording was probably around maybe 3 or 4 a.m. So I was there for about 4 hours. And then after the recording, and they had, you know, determined that they were going to send me back to Chicago, you know, I kind of decided, like, okay, well, if they already made their decision, I'm kind of going to give them a hard time about it now. So I, before I had to go back to the waiting room, I said, okay, well, I need to go to the bathroom. And a female officer started walking with me. And I looked at her. I'm like, excuse me, what are you doing? She said, I need to take you to the bathroom. I said, why? She said, because you need to be watched. And I was like, excuse me, I need some privacy. And she said, well, I'm not going to go in the stall with you. And I just looked at her like, oh, well, I hope you aren't. Like, who do you think you are? It's a violation. And she waited for me right outside of my stall. And when I got out and she was kind of walking ahead of me, I took my phone out and I was recording just a video camera. And I wasn't even hiding it at this point. I was kind of making a joke, you know, because I wanted to send my friends, like, oh, look at my bathroom babysitter. And that other officer who was in the recording saw me, and he literally snatched my phone out of my hands. And he got in my face. This guy is, like, at least 6'3", you know, he's a big guy. I'm, like, 5'0", and, you know, I'm pretty petite. And he got in my face and he said, who told you to record an immigration officer? Who told you to record her? And I didn't even understand his question. And I told him that. I said, I don't understand your question. He said, who told you? This is illegal. And I said, well, I want to show everybody my bathroom babysitter because this is ridiculous. And he said, you're not getting your phone back until you're in Chicago. I said, give me my phone back. And he said, no. And then when I reached to grab my phone from his hands, he reached for his handcuffs again. And he said, put your hand down or I am arresting you right now. So I'm like, okay. So I went and I waited back in that room. And he comes back to me holding my phone. And he has it opened. And he points to a picture. And it was a picture of me at a Palestinian protest in Chicago, fully decked out in Palestinian gear, a company called Pali Roots that makes Palestinian clothing. And, I mean, I was wearing a shirt that was a Palestinian flag. I was wearing the keffiyeh. I was wearing a Palestinian cap. And I was holding a sign saying one Holocaust doesn't justify another. And he said, is this you? And there was, you know, there was no denying it. I looked at it and I said, yeah. And he swiped to the next picture and it was a different protest, you know, different clothes, but same idea. And he said, and this is you? I said, yeah. And he said, you are a Palestinian and I should arrest you. And he said, you are not going to see your phone until you get back to Chicago. And I thought, oh boy. And the reason that he was able to see those photos was when I was on the plane on my way to Tel Aviv, I started to delete pictures from my album that I thought might, you know, put me at risk for being deported. But I think because it was, you know, I was just traveling for a long time, I deleted them, but I didn't permanently delete. So when he had my phone, he took it so that he could delete the video of the immigration officer that I took. He saw my pictures that I had deleted as well, and he lost it. Again, you know, I seemed fine on the outside, but really I was really nervous. Because, you know, again, I was traveling alone. I couldn't just call my dad and, you know, tell him what was going on. And I even told them, you know, I need to call my family. I need to call the embassy. They said, no, we're not letting you call anybody. And I meant using their phones. And then he comes back after a long while and he says, if I see you using your phone for anything other than a phone call, I'm arresting you. I said, okay. He said, so you better behave yourself. I said, I am behaving. I think you should behave yourself. And he's like, what? Again, you know, he just couldn't, you know, he couldn't stand that I was kind of talking to him that way. And so I was in the room, and after a while, you know, just making me wait because there's nothing I could do. My flight was still in a few hours. A different officer came and told me to follow her. And I just automatically got a bad feeling because at this point, what more do they want from me if they're not going to let me enter? So I follow her, and I was, you know, just carrying my phone, and she told me I couldn't have it out and that it had to be in my backpack. So I put it in my backpack, and we walk to what seemed like the opposite side of the airport. Because I saw we were kind of in the area where baggage claim was, which I thought was weird. Why are they taking me here? And we got to this place, and I couldn't even tell it was a door until she started knocking on it. I mean, there was no handle or anything. But she kept knocking and knocking until a different officer opened the door for her. And I thought, you know, I looked inside, and it looked just really shady. I mean, it was dark. It was cold in there. And I'm like, what is this place? And it's closed off from the rest of the airport. Like, this is not good. So I just had my my carry-on with me and my backpack, and they started to search every single item meticulously. I mean, I had, you know, a can of almonds, and he opened up the can, put the little metal detector thing inside, you know, and it was every single item that I had in there, everything. And, you know, again, it's just to kind of provoke us and, you know, get me upset and riled up, but I tried to stay calm. That took a while. And then they told me to, I was wearing a sweater. I was wearing a sweatshirt. And they told me to take my sweatshirt off because they could see I was wearing a shirt underneath. And, you know, they were checking my sweater, and I kept complaining that I was cold. I said, I'm cold. I'm really cold. I want my sweater back. And they were, you know, they got annoyed, and they just kind of threw the sweater at me. And I wasn't that cold, but, you know, I just wanted to annoy them. So then a different officer came and told me to come inside the room. And it was, you know, even further closed off. And she proceeded to search my body. And it was the longest search ever. It wasn't just the usual, you know, pat down. I mean, this probably took about 20 minutes. And to have your body searched for 20 minutes feels like a lifetime. I mean, she literally pressed every single part of my body, my arms, my legs, my hair even. I mean, she was like, you know, going through my hair and like, what is going on? And then she, I was wearing sweatpants. She told me to, you know, kind of like put my legs apart as I was standing. And she, you know, pulled my pants forward. She pulled them towards her. And she was about to put the metal detector in, and I put my hand there. I said, excuse me, what are you doing? And she said, I have to search. I said, no, that is very violating. That's not okay. She said, well, that's my job. I said, this is a terrible job you have, and this is not okay. You already checked, you know, the area between my legs. And she said, well, I have to check even more. And that was very humiliating because she told me, you know, if I didn't let her, that she was going to arrest me. Right. And I couldn't risk that because then I would have no way to talk to my family and let them know where I was. And so the same with my upper body. I was wearing a sports bra, so there's no metal or anything, and yet she still told me that I needed to remove my bra. And I told her, no, I'm not going to expose myself. She said, you have to do this or you will be arrested. And so I had to take off my bra, and she, you know, searched and pressed, you know, around and underneath my breasts, and
it's okay.
It was very humiliating. It was very humiliating. And there was no one to witness what was happening. They had absolutely no reason to search me since they were not going to let me enter. So it was for pure humiliation. And as down as I felt at that moment, I couldn't show them. And I also just thought about everyone else in Palestine who endures much, much worse than I did. You know?
Yeah.
So that was the worst part.
Did they put you back on a plane to Chicago?
After a few hours, they told me that I'm going to Chicago, and I said, well, who's paying for that ticket? Because my ticket was from Tel Aviv, just to enter Tel Aviv. My ticket wasn't for that same day. And they told me that they were paying for it. And I kind of thought that was weird. I said, that doesn't sound right. And a different officer had to walk me all the way to the plane. And they told me, you're going to Chicago. I said, no, I'm going to try to enter through Jordan. They said, it's not your choice. I said, no, it's not your choice that I am going to enter. And they said, well, as soon as you land in Jordan, your flight to Chicago is 1 hour later. So your bags are going to be transferred onto the next plane. So it's not your choice. And of course, I was panicking inside. I was like, oh my goodness, if I don't have my bags, if I don't have my stuff, you know, if I don't have my passport, that's a problem. Because once we got on the plane, the Israeli officer had to give my passport to the pilot, and it was in an enclosed, you know, a yellow envelope, so I couldn't even hold my passport. They made me sit all the way in the back like I was, you know, some sort of criminal. I wasn't around anyone else, and the pilot asked me, you know, in Arabic, he said, "Inti Palestinia? You know, are you Palestinian?" I said, "Yes, but I'm a U.S. citizen." And he said, "Okay, don't worry, just stay calm." And so when I got off of the plane, the pilot still couldn't give me my passport. I was worried that the Israeli officer was riding the plane with us and was going to make sure that I got on the plane to Chicago. That was my biggest worry. And when I got off the plane and realized he wasn't there, I felt relieved. And there was a Jordanian officer waiting for me, and he had my passport, and, you know, he looked at me and he said, you know, Walat, don't worry, we're going to take care of this. I said, no, you don't understand. My bags are going to be put on the plane to Chicago right now. He said, no, we're going to take care of this. And it was about a 4-hour ordeal in Jordan, you know, just, you know, kind of stopping my bags from getting put on the plane and then changing my ticket information. And, you know, it was quite a hassle, but I was able to change my flight, and I spent the night in Jordan, because the next day I was going to try to go through the Allenby Bridge. And I had made arrangements with my relatives in Palestine to pick me up from there. And Allenby Bridge, although it is still managed by Israel, They are nothing like the officers in Tel Aviv. They still, you know, kind of ask me questions, but they are just very general. And I was granted a visa to enter Palestine.
Wow. After all of that.
What a relief. Yeah, I was crying from how happy I was once I, you know, entered Palestine. And that was one of the best moments of my life. And as tired as I was and as exhausted as I was, I don't think I've ever felt more alive at that moment.
What was the first thing you did when you got to your family's house?
Well, my uncle picked me up, and on our way back from the Allenby Bridge, we stopped by this place in Arija, and we got falafel sandwiches. It was the best sandwich I've ever had in my life.
Well, Othman, throughout all of this, it's kind of remarkable how tenacious you were and how determined you were not to let this interrogation and the harassment and, you know, the 20-minute pat down, all of that interfere with your belief that you would get in. What do you hope this experience, your experience, can tell others, especially Palestinian people who, you know, hold whatever citizenship, who want to be able to just visit their family in Palestine?
You know, I think that Palestinian people in general are very resilient. And I think that people kind of are sometimes worried to go back because of the harassment that they endure. But I think a big form of resistance is for us to continue visiting our homeland. You know, despite the trouble that they give us, we resist by continuing to visit. And I would encourage everyone who can visit, whether it's through Tel Aviv or through Jordan, or through any way that they could enter, to go and visit Palestine, because that's our homeland, and it's our right to visit, and it's our right to be there. And, you know, through my recording, I wanted to expose Israel for the inhumane criminals that they are. And so I'm glad that people will get to see them for what they are, and that I was able to tell them a very simple truth, that they are not nice. So.
The electronic intifada.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Medea Benjamin of Code Pink Women for Peace, who examines charges that Saudi Arabia ordered the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi in the context of the kingdom's gross human rights abuses ignored by successive U.S. administrations over many decades. Michelle Chan of Friends of the Earth, who discusses the new UN report on climate change, which forecasts dire consequences if international action isn't taken to limit an increase in global temperatures. And Nick Abraham of the Yes on 1631 campaign, who talks about a Washington state ballot measure this November that, if approved by voters, would impose a carbon emissions fee on the state's largest polluters. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Brazil's far-right presidential candidate Jair Bolsonaro, who was stabbed during the election campaign, is the favorite to win the election to become leader of Latin America's largest nation. Following years of economic austerity and corruption charges against most of Brazil's political parties, Bolsonaro pushed his tough-on-crime rhetoric to win 46% of the vote in the first round of the election. He faces off against Fernando Haddad of the Leftist Workers' Party in the runoff on October 28th. Bolsonaro's social liberal party also made major gains in Congress, raising the possibility that the far right could win a working legislative majority. In his first-round victory speech, Bolsonaro proclaimed his loyalty to family values and warned of an economic downfall in Brazil similar to that of Venezuela. A former army captain who espouses racist and anti-democratic views, Bolsonaro promised to ease restrictions on the sale of guns to battle crime and violence. His emergence has renewed fears of fascism and a new military dictatorship. During the first round of elections, Bolsonaro and his far-right allies easily won Brazil's largest states, São Paulo and Rio de Janeiro. In contrast, the Workers' Party, with its lesser-known candidate, won the poor Northeast, with strong support for the party's social policies. Former Workers' Party president Lula da Silva, whom polls showed was favored to win this election, was forced to withdraw after he was sentenced to 12 years in jail on corruption charges, a conviction he's now appealing to a higher court. A week before a critical election in Bosnia, Serbian candidate Milorad Dodik traveled to Russia to meet President Vladimir Putin. There, Putin wished the nationalist Bosnian Serb leader great success. Dodik won the Serb seat in Bosnia's three-member presidency last weekend. The photo with Putin helped galvanize support for Dodik and inflamed ethnic rivalries in the volatile Balkan state. According to the Associated Press, the Bosnian Serb leader is pushing for ethnic separation from Muslims and Croats in Bosnia and is seen as a key Putin ally, working to undermine American and European influence in the Balkans. Meanwhile, pro-Putin populist parties are surging across Eastern Europe. In Latvia, the party favored by the nation's ethnic Russian minority won the most votes in the nation's October 6th election, but political observers expect it will have a difficult time putting together a coalition government. Longtime Orange County, California Congressman Dana Rohrabacher is increasingly implicated in Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russia's interference in the 2016 U.S. election. In mid-September, as President Trump's former campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, pled guilty to a number of federal crimes, court papers cited Manafort's lobbying of Rohrabacher as part of an illicit scheme. The right-wing congressman, a former speechwriter for Ronald Reagan, is now a leading supporter of improving relations with Vladimir Putin's Russia. This fall, Rohrabacher, who has served in Congress for three decades, faces the race of his political life, as polls show him tied with Democrat Harley Ruda in a Republican-leaning district. Rohrabacher, who heads a House subcommittee on Russia, has promoted pro-Kremlin policies, like repeal of the Magnitsky Act, which imposed sanctions on members of Putin's inner circle. According to the Los Angeles Times, Rohrabacher is among the most prominent foes of the consensus among U.S. intelligence agencies that Russian hackers stole digital files from the Democratic National Committee and Clinton campaign chair John Podesta. During a trip to Moscow in April 2016, Rohrabacher met with Russian lawyer Natalia Veselnitskaya and lobbyist Renat Akhmetshin, who both attended the infamous Trump Tower meeting with Donald Trump Jr. The congressman also met with WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange at the Ecuadorian embassy in August 2017, when Assange repeated his denial that Russia was involved in the theft and release of Clinton campaign documents. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Jamal Khashoggi, a U.S. resident, Washington Post columnist, and a leading critic of Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, disappeared on October 2nd after entering the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey, where he was directed to go to retrieve documents needed to marry his fiancée. The Turkish government says it has audio and video recordings that confirmed suspicions that Khashoggi was interrogated and murdered inside the Saudi consulate, with his body dismembered and later removed. Condemnation of the Saudi monarchy has reverberated around the world for what many believe was Saudi de facto leader Mohammed bin Salman's order for Khashoggi's murder. President Trump parroted Saudi denials of responsibility for the murder and dismissed calls for the U.S. to sanction Saudi Arabia, stating that Khashoggi was not a U.S. citizen and that canceling weapon sales to the oil-rich kingdom would cost American jobs. Recent press reports indicate that the Saudi government may soon admit their plan was to abduct Khashoggi and take him back to Saudi Arabia, but that the journalist was accidentally killed during an interrogation. Your reporter spoke with Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink Women for Peace and author of the book Kingdom of the Unjust Behind the U.S.-Saudi Connection. Here she examines charges that Saudi Arabia is responsible for Khashoggi's death in the context of the kingdom's gross human rights abuses, ignored by successive U.S. administrations over many decades.
Well, Saudi Arabia has been a repressive country for many decades, but this has gotten worse under Mohammed bin Salman when he came to basically be the one in power because his father, King Salman, is old, has dementia. This was about 3 years ago when he was only 30 years old. He was the one that got Saudi Arabia in the internal affairs in Yemen, causing a catastrophic war. He's been responsible for a crackdown on human rights activists, and he's also been involved in many overseas adventures that have divided the Gulf states, like the economic blockade that he has put on Qatar, the temporary kidnapping of the prime minister of Lebanon, and his vicious attacks on Iran. And that is to sort of set the stage, because he's been portrayed in the United States as a great reformer and a liberal, which he is not. So this latest episode in which a journalist for the Washington Post, a Saudi national but a U.S. resident with children that are American citizens, was told to go to Turkey to get the papers he needed for his divorce so he could remarry. And when he went in, he did not come out alive. And so for the last almost 2 weeks, the Saudi government denied that it knew anything. They said he came in and he came out. Of course, there was no camera footage of him having left, and his fiance had been waiting and waiting and waiting. It looks like now they're going to announce that indeed they did kill him, but it was an accident. It was done by rogue elements in the government. They were supposed to kidnap him and bring him back to Saudi Arabia. Things went badly, and instead he was killed.
Medea, summarize for us a bit about Donald Trump and his administration's response to the allegations against Saudi Arabia for the charge that they murdered this dissident journalist, Jamal Khashoggi.
There has been quite an outcry in the United States, even from very conservative Republican congresspeople like Lindsey Graham, or who said there would be hell to pay, or Marco Rubio, who said we'd have to recalibrate our relations with Saudi Arabia. But from Donald Trump, first it has been silence, then it was downplaying it, then it was saying that, well, no matter what happened, we're not going to want to cut off weapon sales because that's jobs and a lot of money, and that those orders would just go to the Chinese or the Russians. And then he threw out this idea of maybe it was a rogue element, which really set the stage for what the Saudis are going to make up now as their excuse. So all along, he's been trying to either make this story go away or cover it up.
Medea, in your view, what is the proper response of the United States here to what almost certainly was the death of this journalist, Jamal Khashoggi? What should the United States be doing here?
They should certainly be cutting off not only all weapon sales to Saudi Arabia, but immediately stop aiding and abetting the Saudis in the horrendous war in Yemen. They should impose sanctions on anybody who is involved in this heinous act of killing the journalist. They should stop intelligence cooperation with the Saudis. And I think then there's also an issue about businesses, and businesses really should sever their ties, particularly those businesses that are hired to be foreign agents of the Saudi government, and there are over two dozen of them. And then there's also the responsibility of the think tanks, the universities in the United States that receive Saudi money, and the high-tech companies that have been courting large investments from the Saudis. All of these kind of connections really need to be rethought. And then on the larger issue, what really would be the positive silver lining that could possibly come from all of this is a rethinking of U.S. policy that has been one that is focused on the interests of Saudi Arabia and Israel instead of the United States, and has dragged the United States into wars it shouldn't be in, put the United States on a collision course with Iran that is hurting many Iranians because of the draconian sanctions, but could also lead us to another war there. So I think with the American public now having somewhat of an understanding of how repressive Saudi Arabia is, perhaps it is a moment when we could create some distance between U.S. policy and the interests of the Saudi government.
That was Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink Women for Peace and author of the book Kingdom of the Unjust, Behind the U.S.-Saudi Connection. Learn more about Saudi Arabia's human rights violations and war crimes by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In a sobering report released by the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, on October 8th, the world's leading climate scientists issued a dire warning that the nations of the world have only a 10 to 12-year window to take action to limit an increase in global temperatures below 1.5 degrees centigrade. The report concludes that an increase beyond 1.5 degrees will substantially increase the likelihood of disastrous drought, wildfires, crop failures, flooding, extreme weather events, and coral reef destruction. The report lays out the case for urgent international action to limit a rise in global warming, to reduce carbon and greenhouse gas emissions. The recommended measures include increasing the cost of burning fossil fuels, reforestation, changes in land use, moving to electric-powered transport systems, and the adoption of carbon capture technology. Your reporter spoke with Michelle Chan, Friends of the Earth Vice President of Programs, who discusses the warnings and recommendations found in the UN Climate Change Report, as well as the political obstacles in the U.S., where President Trump and the Republican Party that controls all branches of government refuses to acknowledge or take action to address climate change.
In 2015, at the Paris climate talks, countries agreed to a couple of goals. And the first one was to limit the increase in global average temperature to 2 degrees below pre-industrial levels. And then the second goal is to try to stay under 1.5 degrees centigrade. And so this report, which was prepared by hundreds of scientists under the auspices of the IPCC, or the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, this report was done in order to describe how the impacts on Earth and to people would be different between these two different scenarios, 2 degree temperature warming versus 1.5 degrees of warming. And so that was what the report set out to do. And one of the things that the report says is that, you know, even if the world doesn't emit one additional ton of greenhouse gases, even if we were to stop today, that we're already on a path to increasing global average temperatures by 1 degree. And this level, we have to remind ourselves, at this level, people are already suffering and dying because of climate impacts. And then the report goes on to describe what would happen, the difference between 1.5 degrees of warming and 2 degrees of warming. And I can get into a couple of examples if you'd like.
Could you cover for us some of the most dire warnings here that were the consensus of scientists across the world?
Right. Well, they go through a number of different projected impacts between the 1.5 versus 2 degree scenarios. And for example, if we only warm by 1.5 degrees Celsius, then it means that sea level rises won't be as high. And that would mean we could avoid displacing like a million people. So if we went up to 2 degrees, that would mean 10 million people already, you know, would be essentially forced to move. At 1.5 degrees, the science says that we'll lose maybe 70% of our coral reefs instead of 99% of them. So, I mean, 1.5, even though that's the goal the world is shooting for, still is eye-poppingly devastating for the state of our coral reefs and our oceans. But at 1.5 degrees of warming, instead of that 2, we can help prevent what scientists call feedback loops. These feedback loops create runaway climate change. So one example here is that Arctic snow, being white, has the ability to bounce back the sun's rays into space. And the more Arctic snow we lose, then the more the Earth absorbs that heat, and then the more melting is caused, and then there's less snow and less sunlight reflected back. And so that just creates a vicious cycle or a feedback loop. And so the report goes and just chronicles all of these different scenarios, likely scenarios, likely impacts between 1.5 and 2 degrees. And it's very, very sobering, to say the least. It says that technologically, if we go over 1.5 degrees, then we will need to increasingly rely on technologies that suck carbon out of the air. And a lot of these technologies are just completely unproven, and they could be hugely risky.
Well, Michelle, when you look at the advisory here to the world in terms of the dramatic action that will be necessary to stay under that 1.5 degrees centigrade rise in temperature across the world, how realistic is it that that could actually happen in terms of political will, technology, alternative fuel systems, and the like?
Yeah, it's a great question, Scott, because ultimately, Friends of the Earth believes that we need political and not just technological solutions to tackle climate change. This report that the IPCC put out was pretty technological. It didn't seek to really answer the big hairy questions about whether or not, for example, we can get corporations and big oil companies out of our government, as they are blocking us from making these radical transformations in our energy, food, and economic systems that we all need and that the science says we need, right? So it's a really good question about how to tackle this from a political perspective. And that's why, you know, for example, Friends of the Earth has, you know, is working against voter suppression in North Carolina and in other states, because it's the fact that the most marginalized people, the people in this country as well as abroad, that have the most to lose, that have the most at risk, that have the most on the line from the impacts of climate change, are also being politically dispossessed. I mean, that is part of the climate change problem, and it's hard to sometimes to make that fast connection. But I think that all of your listeners, you know that we need to look at climate change from a political lens and not just, you know, a technological one.
That was Michelle Chan, Vice President of Programs with Friends of the Earth U.S. Find links to the new UN climate report, as well as related analysis and commentary, by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The state of Washington is attempting for the second time in 3 years to impose a carbon emissions fee through a statewide initiative this November on the state's largest polluters, like the oil industry and utilities, that have not switched over to clean energy. If approved by the state's voters, it would be the first of its kind in the U.S. The Yes on I-1631 campaign was buoyed by a poll conducted in early October that found 50% approval among 400 registered voters polled, with 36% opposed and 14% undecided. Thus far, opponents have spent $22 million and claim the 1631 ballot measure would cost families hundreds of dollars a year. Supporters who spend a little more than a third as much at $8 million say the initiative would cost families only about $10 a month. They say the money raised would be applied to renewable energy and energy efficiency projects that will save consumers money in the long run, while reducing the state's use of fossil fuels and decrease carbon emissions. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Nick Abraham, communications director with the Yes on 1631 campaign. Here he talks about the history of the fight and what passage would mean for Washington and the U.S. as a whole.
This time around, we have the largest coalition in Washington state history. So, you know, last time they had a pretty small group of folks that decided on a policy that they thought would work best. But, you know, this time around, we are including the largest labor organizations, the largest community of color groups, the, you know, of course, the environmental community, but also, you know, over 250 local businesses, health organizations like the American Lung Association, the Academy of Family Physicians, faith groups like Earth Ministry, and a whole host of cardinals and churches that have endorsed our campaign. So, you know, I think that's what's most inspiring to us and is what been our strongest message with the public, is that we are all on board here, and that's a really powerful juxtaposition to who our opposition with. That is, you know, and the No campaign is 99% funded by six multinational oil companies.
So what does Initiative 1631 actually do?
This initiative would put a carbon fee on the state's largest polluters. Those end up being, you know, the oil industry and utilities that haven't yet switched over to clean energy for the most part. You know, we did not put this cost on the average consumer. We really feel that these companies that are causing the most harm should be the ones to pay this fee. Take that carbon fee and fund it into clean energy projects and bolstering our state's natural resources so that we can clean more of our air and adapt to the changes we know are coming from climate change.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Nick Abraham, but I believe a major factor in the defeat of a carbon price initiative in Washington 2 years ago was the split between the supporters and what's called the environmental justice community, representing low-income folks and people of color who are the ones hurt first and worst by climate impacts.
Yeah, you know, that is generally right. You know, the environmental justice community had a couple of really clear points that we now feel are really well reflected in this initiative. You know, communities of color and low-income folks have been the hardest hit by pollution for decades. And we want to make sure that in whatever solutions we're creating, that they are front and centered in solving that problem. So ensuring that we are investing back in those communities that are hardest hit, that we are not leaving them behind in this transition, and we're ensuring that more people and more communities are included in the clean energy economy and aren't left out, as so many folks have been when we're using coal and oil. The most vulnerable people in our state are the ones who are hardest hit.
The fee is so much smaller than what scientists say is needed to bring down greenhouse gas emissions. If this initiative passes, is it going to do any good or enough good?
This is a very modest first step that we're trying to take here. And, you know, I think we've been delaying for a long time now, and I think folks know that it's time we have to get started with this. But yeah, you know, this fee would start at about $15 a ton. Washington State has pollution reduction goals. You know, we, like so often, our legislature set goals but with no plan to get there. So we have been missing those targets since 2008. But this fee and investment structure makes sure that we are getting back on track, that we are investing and raising the price $2 a year until we reach those goals in 2035. And once we reach those, there's a cap on the price, and we are just continuing to make those investments so that we can stay on track to reduce pollution. But, you know, the real crux of where we're going to get that pollution reduction, you know, the place we know we're going to start moving away from oil is through these investments. So investing in things like clean energy, of course, but also, you know, energy efficiency, so we can bring down people's electric bills. They just don't have the funds to invest in those things up front. And then again, yeah, really investing in our state's natural resources. So because we know trees and our forests are some of the easiest ways that we can clean the air.
Of course, the opponents say the big polluters will just pass on the cost to consumers.
Yeah, so we know they couldn't pass on all these costs. They wouldn't be spending $20 million of stockholder funding if they thought they could just pass on all these costs. But we know that at a maximum, if they were to pass every penny of this down, it wouldn't cost folks more than $10 to $12 a month for the average household.
Would this be the first effort of its kind in the U.S. if it passes?
Yeah, so this would be the first carbon price in the United States. And I think more importantly, it would be the first major climate pollution policy to ever be passed by a vote of the people. So this is such a big validator to show, yes, people want this. Yes, people are tired of not doing anything on this issue and just continuing to kick the can down the road. This is a huge validator for saying that people want to take action, and they have had a direct vote and opportunity to say that.
That was Nick Abraham, communications director with Washington State's Yes on 1631 campaign. Learn more about the Yes on 1631 initiative by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our newly designed and mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRFI in Ithaca, New York, WZMO in Marion, Ohio, KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, The Michael Slate Show.
Right, you can't say yes while you're waiting for a cure. There you go. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've got a great show today, actually.
At the back end of the show, I'll be airing an interview that I did earlier this year with Kate Morgan of No More Deaths about an important, powerful, and disturbing report on immigrant deaths in the borderland north of the U.S.-Mexico border. And before that, we'll be hearing the trailer from Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. Now, that's a film of a recent speech given by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. There has never been a film like this on this subject until now, and it premieres online on October 19th. At the back end of the show, I'll be airing an interview that I did earlier this year with Kate Morgan of No More Deaths. And before that, we'll be hearing the trailer from Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution, the film of a recent speech given by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. Now, there's never, ever been a film like this on this subject until now, anywhere, okay? And it premieres online on October 19th. And in addition to sitting your own butts down to watch this film and think about it and talk with your friends about it and spread word about it, actually try to get as many people as possible to be tuning in to RevCom.us on October 19th to watch the film themselves and spread it to their friends and all over the country, all right? That's what we need to be doing these days. This is the kind of thing that people need to be talking about, struggling over, and it's the kind of thing we need right now. Opening the show up, however, I'm really pleased to be bringing you Annette Clapstein and Emily Johnson. They're the valve turners.
All right. You've heard of the valve turners. They close the valves on pipelines in Minnesota that carry tar sands oil into the U.S., a direct action to shut down fossil fuel production and halt the destruction of the only livable planet that we got. You got that? Let's repeat that. To stop the destruction of the only livable planet we've got. A judge dismissed the charges before the trial. At the trial, they plan to defend their actions as necessary to save human civilization. That doesn't sound very important, does it? Yeah. All right. And Emily, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Annette, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
Sure. And let me just say real quick, Annette, is it Klapstein or Klapstein?
I say Steen. Half the family says Stein. I'll answer to either.
We could make a song out of that. We ought to go with that. All right.
Yeah, there we go.
All right. And that is a retired attorney for the Puyallup tribe and member. Okay.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And member of the Raging Grannies. Okay. And she believes that our current economic and political system is a death sentence to life on Earth. Yeah. Couldn't agree more. And that she must do everything in her power to replace these systems with cooperative, just, equitable, and love-centered ways of living together. And Emily Johnson is a poet and a co-founder of 350seattle.org. She has said that for years we've tried the legal, incremental, reasonable methods, and they haven't been anything like enough. Without a radical shift in our relationship to this, things aren't going to change, all right? So both of you, welcome. Emily, welcome. The rest of you, it's really...
Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's really good to have you on. So let's jump into this right away. Let's go with Emily first. Emily, on October 11th, 2016, there was an action that you and, you know, both of you were actually involved in this, and then we'll have your comments on in a minute, but that you actually pulled together this action that was meant to break something out into the air in a big way. What was that? Explain to people what you did and why.
So what we did, Michael, was together with three other friends who were turning valves and with several friends who were acting as support people and videographers, we shut down all of the major tar sands bitumen pipelines into the United States. So Annette and I shut down two pipelines owned by Enbridge that were in Minnesota. Our friend Michael shut down the original Keystone pipeline in North Dakota. Our friend Leonard shut down the Spectra, it was then called the Spectra pipeline in Montana. And our friend Ken shut down the Trans Mountain pipeline in Washington State. And we did that because, you know, tar sands is the worst of the worst when it comes to oil, the dirtiest form of oil there is. It's the thing about which former NASA scientist James Hansen said it is game over for the climate if we develop the tar sands.
Mm-hmm. And Annette, what was with you? You were involved in that as well, right?
With Emily in Minnesota shutting down the two Enbridge pipelines.
Now, what brought you there?
What brought me there?
Yeah.
desperation to have a livable climate for my children and all future generations. Mm-hmm. We are at such a dire place when it comes to what's been done about climate change compared to what the effects that it's already having around the world. Thousands of people are already dying, and the IPCC report made clear that it could be hundreds of millions of people dying as early as 2040 from the effects of climate change. So this is absolutely morally unacceptable to me, and I cannot stand idly by and watch that happen without doing everything in my power to stop it.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, Emily, tell me this. You were responding to a request for action in solidarity with Standing Rock, with what went on with Standing Rock. Tell us about that somewhat.
Well, you know, to be perfectly honest, we definitely would have done this action regardless. It seemed absolutely essential to us to do something like this, but we did choose the timing in order to be respectful to the call for direct action from Standing Rock. So, yeah, and I had been there, you know, about a month and a half before, and, you know, we were trying to figure out how to most be aligned with what was happening at Standing Rock and not in any way try to overshadow it, but to work in concert with it.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me this, Annette, you know, there was a whole question of, when we were talking about it, actually just now, standing in solidarity with Standing Rock, but there was also a point where you guys actually said, look, we are going to tell these people, we are going to tell the people that are running all this, that are destroying the planet, we're going to warn them, but then we're going to go ahead with this. Talk about that. When you came, because that's a big decision to make, you know, it's sort of like, you're sort of like giving them, okay, do it or pay the price.
Yeah, we made safety calls. Basically, we wanted to do this, but we wanted to do it in the safest possible way. And we knew that the safest possible way was to get them to shut down the pipelines remotely. This action of shutting down pipelines had been done before in Canada. That's where we got the idea. Several people have done it several times up there. But, you know, we wanted this to be very safe and So we had somebody in Seattle call the pipeline companies 15 minutes before people were scheduled to arrive in each state. And then we each had a support person on site who called the pipeline company again 5 minutes before we were going to turn it down. So, you know, we had it all staggered 15 minutes apart. So there would be, you know, plenty of time to do this. So, yes, you know, it was go ahead and shut it down remotely, or we are now cutting the chains and we'll go in there and, you know, turn the wheels and shut off these emergency safety valves.
Mm-hmm. So it was actually do it or we're going to do it. So that's it. So that was kind
exactly.
of, yeah, very, yeah. very important. Now, you shut down, you guys shut down 15%, if I'm right on this, that you shut down 15% of U.S. crude oil imports, which was almost a whole day of their crude oil imports. What was the impact of that?
Well, in the immediate sense, there was no impact to people because they have plenty backed up and plenty of supply in storage. But the impact to them was quite dramatic, both in terms of delayed profits and in terms of just waking up to the fact that people are going to fight these pipelines and that we are going to do everything we can peacefully and nonviolently to shut down tar sands operations, because we know, you know, tar sands is one of the projects that in a 2015 study that delineated which forms of fossil fuel which projects we cannot engage in and still have a stable climate. Tar sands was one of those things. And they said by 2020, we have to have, quote, negligible, end quote, extraction of the tar sands going on. And instead, they're trying to build new pipelines. They're trying to ramp it up. It's totally crazy.
Mm-hmm. Now, you also called. Go ahead.
I was just going to say their share price dropped the next day fairly dramatically.
Yes.
And, you know, that is the only thing they care about. And that is what gets their attention. So if we did this more, it would have, I think, a very significant effect.
Mm-hmm. Now, you also
absolutely.
Go ahead.
Sorry, Michael.
That's all right.
I was going to say the internet is absolutely right. And what that also means is basically, you know, this is a very similar fight in some ways. They're all quite similar to the Shell No fight that we had in the Northwest against Arctic drilling. And by that, I mean that the companies get taken by surprise when there is massive public opposition. And the way you create massive public opposition is to educate people about why some projects are so much worse than others, how urgent climate change is, et cetera. And people respond, you know, to actions like ours in exactly the way that Annette said, you know, that the share price goes way down, because all of a sudden people understand that the existing system is vulnerable and it's problematic, and people are beginning to wake up to that.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Annette Klopstein, who's a retired attorney for the Puyup tribe and a member of the Raging Grannies, and Emily Johnston, who is a poet and co-founder of 350seattle.org. And both of them actually basically did something that was really, really great and was really the world needs to see a lot more of this. When they stepped in and they said, nope, we're not going to settle for this kind of what's going on with all this oil and all the things that are going on, U.S. crude oil imports and all the things that's happening in the world in the name of all that and because of all that. And they said, we're not allowing this to go on our watch. We're going to step up and stop things. And that was an incredibly important thing. Now, you also called out Obama on this, right, which I thought was pretty good and pretty interesting.
Yeah, we did. We sent him a letter inviting him very strongly to keep those pipelines off, because if that was done, that would be a 15% cut in the oil use in the United States. And that is the magnitude of cuts we need to make every year in order to salvage a habitable climate for future generations.
Mm-hmm. And Emily, what was the upshot of that?
Well, sadly, no, that did not happen. We, you know, they turned on the pipelines. They were on average closed for the day, basically. And Obama obviously never responded to our letter. We do know that it was brought to his attention or to the attention of the White House in the briefing that day. So it was a big surprise to everybody that it was possible for, you know, regular citizens to do something like this and to disrupt the system in that way. And I think that was an important message to send.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, one of the things that we have to do if we're going to survive the climate crisis, you know, we heard the IPCC report on Monday. They said we have at most 12 years at current, you know, ex- extracting at the current rate that we are and burning at the current rate. And we all know how unlikely it is that we're going to make that deadline. And it means, you know, millions, if not tens or hundreds of millions of lives and many species and so forth, that we do make it. So we have to shake the system up. And one of the things we have to do in order to shake the system up is to get citizens to understand that we are giving our passive implicit consent when we allow these projects to continue. They have millions of miles of pipeline. They have, oil trains coming through all of our communities. There are trucks and et cetera that we can stop. So if everybody stands up and hundreds of people go to block the oil train tracks, or hundreds of people, go to, make sure that people don't get into work at a coal mine, or make sure, that they park themselves in their governor's office and refuse to leave. You know, all of those things are important, and we need all of them now. People need to remove their consent from these projects.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell us a little bit about what happened. You did end up going to court. You were arrested. You went to court. What happened there?
We had a very shocking week the past week. We were supposed to start our trial on the 8th of October, and a few days before the trial, well, to backtrack, the judge had very surprisingly granted us the necessity defense. None of our other comrades who did this in other states were allowed that. That was appealed up to the Minnesota Supreme Court and upheld. So we were ecstatic that we were going to be able to go into court and present climate science. We had Dr. James Hansen lined up and a bunch of other local climate scientists, et cetera, et cetera. Well, 3 days before the trial, the judge suddenly issued an order saying he was not going to allow any experts to testify to climate change or civil disobedience, which was, of course, the heart of our case. So we were shocked by that and reeling from that and trying to rebuild our case, because the only people who could then testify to climate change was ourselves. And we went to trial on Monday, and on Tuesday, the prosecutor presented his very brief case, which consisted of the sheriff who arrested us and one Enbridge employee. And he basically showed that we had cut some chains and locks, which we never disputed. And at the close of the case, our lawyer, Tim Phillips, made a motion for judgment of acquittal, which is a standard motion that's made in every criminal case. And I, as a lawyer who practiced for 30 years, have never, ever seen that motion granted before, but our judge granted it. And in other words, found us not guilty without us putting on one bit of evidence, just on the basis that the prosecutor had not proved his case.
Mm-hmm. Now, Emily, just to back up a little bit, this climate necessity defense, a lot of people just don't know what that means. You were really surprised that you could actually mount that, propose it, and that was actually going to be the heart of the court case. What is the climate necessity defense?
Yeah, Michael, it's very rarely granted in this country, but it does, it emerges from old English common law. And it basically, the analogy people often use is, if you are walking by a burning building and you hear a baby crying, it is actually completely legal to go in and save that, to break and enter in order to save the baby. And so what we often say is that, the world is on fire and all the world's babies are in it, and so we need to do this. And so the elements of the necessity defense are generally that the harm has to be much greater than the harm you're causing by breaking the law. It has to be imminent. You have to have no legal alternatives, and you have to have reason to believe that what you're doing is an effective way to address the harm. And so we had expert witnesses lined up for each of those facts, multiple ones, a couple for each. And we think it is absolutely incontrovertible that this is what is necessary right now, and that we have that none of the legal alternatives are sufficient. We engage in those legal alternatives all the time. People have been doing it for decades, whether it's meeting with legislators or speaking up at hearings, writing letters, having protests. Everything that we can legally do, people have been doing, again, for decades. It's not working, and we need it to work in the next year or two.
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking about this, because this, all you guys were saying about the this is all occurring in the face of this growing understanding about what the actual danger posed to humanity is in the world today, as
right.
Shown in the United Nations, new intergovernmental panel on climate change that we're referring to. And it really does emphasize the necessity for people to actually one, look at what's happening, take the blinders off and act on it. And it's really important that what you folks did in the world today was extremely, extremely important, you know. And I think in terms of getting this out and getting people to understand that, you know, look, you were people that were, and the people that worked with you were people who were concerned about this, but you did something that, one, could have put you in a lot of jeopardy, could have ended you up in jail and, you know, for a long period of time or whatever. And, but it was basically saying that, look, we have to act. And when we act, it has to be commensurate with the truth of what's happening today. I mean,
the IPCC report, the word that it used, which is not normally a governmental kind of word, is that the change has to be transformational, transformational change in our society. And we also know the IPCC is historically quite conservative, and actually the changes that we need are even more than they are saying that we need. But the most important point is simply that we can still have a huge impact now, and our window to have that huge impact is closing very rapidly. Mm-hmm.
Did you want to add to that, Annette?
Right. Yeah, I would just add that, you know, what we need is system change. You know, incremental changes are not going to do it. I refer back to Naomi Klein's book a few years ago where she, you know, said that, you know, you can have a stable climate or you can have capitalism, but you can't have both. And that's where we're at. Capitalism is going to kill us all, and we have to have a complete system change, and we have to, you know, have the people have a say in what these fossil fuel companies are doing, because they're going to destroy us all.
Now, there is some information that people really got to grab hold of, really got to grab hold of in terms of what needs to be done, what we're facing and what needs to be done. And that's, you know, that's something that comes through all the way. And I was wondering, do you, you know, the other people who were part of this action in other parts of the country, that they actually was this, you know, and I've been following, I have a friend, Jen Marlowe, who has actually been working around some of the people down south who are, you know, there's a big thing around an oil development down there, and it's going to just ruin all these people's lives and stuff. But there's all these things, like, do you see, like, in terms of what do you see happening? Because it was really significant, one, you guys were able to do this, but then two, that you were able to use to a certain, even get in the front door, this whole idea of the climate necessity defense, but then the door gets slammed shut. But in all these other cases, what's happening with them?
Well, unfortunately, you know, we know that, for instance, people who were at Standing Rock, particularly the indigenous folks, are getting, you know, hit with huge sentences on felony charges. And we know that we were treated more gently because we're old white people. Older white people, in Emily's case, middle-aged white people, but I'm 66 years old, you know, and so is Leonard. And, you know, I keep saying that that's why old white people need to get out and do this, because we aren't as great at greater a risk. And, you know, we have to look at, you know, what we're leaving for our children, our grandchildren, future generations. That's our job. That's our job to protect them. And if we go to jail, we go to jail. If we get a felony conviction, we get a felony conviction. I mean, I went into this fully expecting to get a conviction and quite possibly to do prison time. It's not that I want to. Of course, nobody wants to do it. It's horrible. It's a horrible system. It ought to be abolished. But if that's what it takes to turn it around, then old white people need to get their butts out there and do it. Because for one thing, you know, we don't have jobs anymore. You know, if we're retired, we don't have to worry about having a felony conviction on our record. We don't have kids at home to support. And when the police do show up, they won't shoot us the way they will do to our young friends of color. So, you know, this is an important role that older white people can play in the movement. And I say it's our job and our duty to just step up and do that.
Emily, you have anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, sure. I would say, I mean, I absolutely agree with Annette. And I would also add that this work is the most important work anybody could be doing right now. And that also brings a lot of joy. So it's not just about duty. It's also about the fact that when you are fighting for fighting for life on Earth and for the continuation of the human species, you know, there is a kind of moral clarity and a joy to that that is so, so important. And the people in this movement are amazing. And I would just recommend that everybody who's listening to this show get out there, talk to their neighbors, talk to their friends, and see what they can band together and do to make the kind of change that we need in order to have a livable world. Because, like I said, we have very little time left, but we do have some time left. And that is the most important message people can have, because I know that people get paralyzed by the scope of climate change and the threats that it poses to us. So, you know, whether we're saving, you know, some communities being able to live where they live now for a few extra decades, whether we're saving more species, whether we're minimizing the number of human deaths, all of those things are so worth fighting for, and we can still fight for them. So we have to, and it's beautiful work to do.
Absolutely. And is there a way that people can get hold of you and the folks that you work with?
Shutitdown.today. That's our website.
Shutitdown.today.
Right.
Okay, pretty good.
We also have a Facebook page. It's Shut It Down Climate Direct Action.
Shut It Down
Climate Direct Action.
Climate Direct Action.
That's okay. The Facebook page. You can reach us on either of those.
Okay, great. All right, I want to thank both of you for joining us today. It's really and let's stay in touch, because this is really one of the most important things people can be paying attention to in the world today.
All right.
So, okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having us.
Sure, definitely. Thank you both. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Annette Klapstein, who's a retired attorney for the Puyallup tribe and member of the Raging Grannies. And she believes that our current economic and political system is a death sentence to life on Earth, and that she's got to do everything in her power to replace these systems with cooperative, just, equitable, and love-centered ways of living together. And Emily Johnston, who is a poet and co-founder of 350Seattle.org, and she said that for years we've tried the legal, incremental, reasonable methods, and they haven't been anything like enough. Without a radical shift in our relationship to this, nothing's going to happen, and we need that radical shift. And I want to thank both of them for that. Again, people really, really need to, one, check out what's going on with this, but also think about the whole reasoning, you know, because they always try to tell us that, you know, you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't do that, you should modify things. Don't go too far. But actually, when you're dealing with a question of the survival of the entire planet on anything else that's on it, and that's both in terms of the kinds of systems you have as well as what they're doing to this thing, you got to stand up and pay attention. You got to decide what's right and what's wrong, and what are you going to do about it, all right? And in that spirit, I want to remind everyone of an important date. October 19th is the online premiere of the film of a speech by Bob Avakian, Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. So here's the trailer for the film, which you can access from revcom.us.
Why we need an actual revolution and how we can really make revolution. How many more times do the tears and the cries of anguish and anger have to pour forth from the wounded hearts of people? White supremacy, male supremacy, wars of empire, the demonization, criminalization, and deportations of immigrants, the destruction of the planet. Why is this the state of humanity? There is one fundamental reason. The basic nature of the system of capitalism, imperialism that we live under, and the way, because of its very nature, it continually perpetrates and perpetuates horror after horror. And in fundamental terms, we have two choices. Either live with all this and condemn future generations to the same, or worse, if they have a future at all, or make revolution. An actual revolution does not mean trying to make some changes within this system. It means overthrowing this system and bringing into being a radically different and far better system. A revolution aiming not just to abolish oppression, exploitation, poverty, and misery in one country, but having as its fundamental goal the abolition of all this throughout the world and the elimination of all borders and boundaries that erect walls between the different parts of humanity. Let's be honest. This is a difficult road. But there is no other way to finally put an end to the horrors that are continually brought forth by this system. And as hard as this is, it is possible if we go about it the right way, with the right outlook and approach, the right goals and methods, the right strategy and plan. So this is what I'm going to dig into through the course of this talk. Revolution is possible, and we have to go to work to make it real.
That was Bob Avakian, chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and the film was Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. Now, this can be seen on October 19th at revcom.us. And really, get your friends together, get everybody you know, tell people you don't know. Check out this film. It's the kind of thing we need in the air and in our heads right now. Now we're going to hear my interview with Kate Morgan from No More Deaths on their report on death in the borderland. This report calls attention to a significant, albeit underreported, outcome of contemporary U.S. border policing strategy and practice. The disappearance of tens of thousands of migrants and refugees in the expansive wilderness north of the U.S.-Mexico border. This process of disappearance is related to the much more thoroughly researched and reported deaths of thousands of border crossers since the 1994 launch of the U.S. Border Patrol's strategy of prevention through deterrence. These are words found in the opening paragraph of a brand new report that's just been issued called Disappeared: How the U.S. Border Enforcement Agencies Are Fueling a Missing Persons Crisis. And the report was issued by La Coalición de Derechos Humanos and No More Deaths. All right, and I'm really pleased to welcome to the show Kate Morgan. Kate works with No More Deaths, which was one of the groups, as I said, that participated in coming up with it and developing this whole new report called Disappeared: How the U.S. Border Enforcement Agencies Are Fueling a Missing Persons Crisis. Kate, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Sure. Your report, we're going to jump right into this because we have a lot to talk about. So your report.
Great.
Disappeared: How the U.S. Border Enforcement Agencies Are Fueling a Missing Persons Crisis. Let's give people a broad overview of the report, what it is, and what compelled the two groups that participated in making this report to issue it.
Sure. So No More Deaths, along with La Coalición de Derechos Humanos, started working on this report a couple of years ago while they were operating a missing persons hotline. So in 2015, they're operating a hotline where families of folks who had crossed, who had gone missing, could call to talk to someone about the whereabouts of their family member. In 1 year, they received almost 12,000 calls to the effect of, one of my loved ones has attempted to cross the border. I haven't heard from them. I believe that they have gone missing or they have disappeared. And we started hearing that language so many times, this language of disappearance. We knew that there was already a very strong narrative about the number of people who die while crossing the desert. We know that almost 8,000 people have died in the U.S. borderlands since the late 1990s. But what we hadn't heard very many people talking about was this crisis of disappearance that was happening in the borderlands. And so we decided to come together to write the report called Disappeared: How U.S. Border Enforcement Agencies Are Fueling Missing Persons Crisis. The report itself focuses on three different tactics that happen in the field that contribute to the crisis of disappearance. The first portion of the report is called Deadly Apprehension Methods, and it focuses on U.S. Border Patrol's practices in remote areas, such as chasing and scattering groups that commonly result in the disorientation and dispersal of individuals into life-threatening terrain in the borderlands. Part two focused on destruction of the interference with humanitarian aid, and it looks at the vandalism and removal of life-preserving humanitarian aid supplies by Border Patrol agents and details law enforcement's routine harassment and interference with humanitarian aid work in the Southwest border zone And part three, which we are working on right now, is going to look at emergency non-response. So the discriminatory lack of emergency responses for undocumented people who initiate a 911 call, and it's either not answered or it is answered very late and results in the disappearance of migrants in the borderlands.
Mm-hmm. Give people a sense of the numbers of people that we're talking about here.
Of the numbers of people who are crossing?
Yes, crossing, and the numbers of people who disappear.
Oh, of the number of people who have disappeared. So we really, it's hard to say how many people are disappeared. We know, for example, again, that this number of about 8,000 people's remains have been found in the borderlands since the late 1990s. And some experts think that for as many as 10 times that number of people have been disappeared. And so it's really hard to tell because the disappearance is a reference to people whose remains are never found or who are never accounted for in detention facilities. We can't find them in hospitals. They actually just completely go disappeared by the border itself. And so it's really hard for us to give an exact number. But we believe that it is a crisis of thousands and thousands of people.
Mm, boy. You know, one of the thing in terms of, we talk about the numbers of people, but what about who these people are? I really want people to get a sense of the humanity of these people. Like, so who are they? If you can help us out with that, you know, give people a sense of who these people are and what actually compels them to try and cross the border on foot. Because crossing the border on foot has to be something that's pretty daunting when you first think about it. And it's, you know, it does seem to be, or is it? Is this a new development, a newer development in terms of people coming into the country on foot?
Yeah, so this question about who are we seeing cross the border or who are we seeing who has disappeared, I guess I would really encourage listeners to think of who are their neighbors and who are the people who are their coworkers and the people who take their kids to school, because the population of folks who are crossing the border is not a monolith, and it's honestly a lot of people who probably we may never guess that are a part of our lives already. Certainly, we already hear the stories of people who are fleeing violence in Honduras. That's a country that political and economic stability can be directly attributed to intervention by the U.S. government and the coup in the late 2000s, well, the 2009. We see people who are fleeing because of gang violence in El Salvador and Guatemala, and we see people who are leaving simply out of poverty. I hear people say, I can't feed myself and my family, and that's why I've decided to make this journey north. We're looking right now, in this current moment, we see the caravan of folks from Central America who have arrived at the Tijuana-San Diego port, and our asylum seekers asking for entrance and being denied. You know, we can see examples of many people who are attempting to cross the border. And I think it's really important for people to remember that the act of crossing a very, very deadly border is a great act of love, actually, that people don't leave their communities and their homelands, their families, without some reason of love either propelling them forward or drawing them to the United States. And so I guess that's from my standpoint, that's sort of the narrative that I want people to be thinking about, is that people are making the most dangerous journey of their life to make it even to this border, and then this border itself is quite deadly. And it's simply just the people who live around us already who are being forced to cross through those borderland regions.
Mm-hmm. One more question before we jump into the report itself. The category of disappeared, and you've used this term a lot, and it's a lot in the literature, the category of people disappearing and just the use of that term disappeared. Why this word?
Yeah, so we very intentionally chose the language of the disappeared, one, to be able to reflect the language that we were hearing in family members who are making the calls to the hotlines, but also to be able to connect it to other movements who have used that language to describe the violence the state-sanctioned violence of disappearances. So many people might be familiar with that language as it appears in Argentina or Chile, maybe even in Central America. We wanted to connect to these other historical moments that people could easily point to and say, actually, yes, that was the machine of the state was part of this crisis of disappearance, because that's the exact same thing that we see happening on the border, that the U.S. government is creating policies and placing infrastructure and militarizing the border that then leads to the crisis of disappearance. And so to be able to connect the language of this moment to the language of historical moments where that has happened as well felt very important to us.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's jump into the report itself. The report's going to be, as you said, it's going to be released in three parts, but two have already come out. So let's start talking about them a little. The first is deadly apprehension methods. Let's talk about that, daily and deadly policing practices.
Sure. So when we say deadly apprehension methods, we're referring to a number of on-the-ground tactics used by Border Patrol agents themselves. One method that we see a lot of and that we hear a lot of people talk about is called chase and scatter. So chase is the active period of pursuit of Border Patrol agents when they attempt to catch or catch up with individuals or a group in order to apprehend them. And scatter refers to when individuals are separated from their group due to Border Patrol intervention and dispersal into the wilderness. So we see this happen a lot with helicopters when we're in the field, actually. We'll see helicopters that are in pursuit, we believe to be in pursuit of a group, and they will actually come down very close to the earth and scatter a group. What the scattering actually leads to is people dropping their things, running away from the group itself, trying to hide, and also actually in many cases that we've heard of people saying, I ran to hide to attempt to protect myself from the blades of the helicopter or of the weight of the helicopter, because that's how close the helicopters are coming in contact with humans. And so when that happens, normally once the helicopter leaves, because the helicopter does not land to actually act in the apprehension, the helicopter leaves after a while. People then very quickly try and pick up what they have and leave that scene before the helicopter returns. So this results in slower moving people, including young people or the very old, the sick, the injured, being left behind in the chaos and alone in the backcountry. It means that people are being separated from the person in the group who would be referred to as the guide, who would know where they were going or even know where they were located in the first place. It means likely that they are being separated from resources or other family members in the group. And so this is just one of the tactics that we see and hear about repeatedly that results in people being disappeared into the wilderness of the border. Another thing that we hear a lot about from folks is just the violent nature of Border Patrol agents themselves. So escalated Border Patrol violence during apprehension is how we refer to that. We hear of people being assaulted by Border Patrol agents. One of our previous reports that came out in 2012 called The Culture of Cruelty looked at this phenomena a little bit closer, looked at the actual number of, we interviewed many people, thousands of people actually, and heard their stories of how many times they were punched or kicked or pushed into cactus by Border Patrol or even held in stress positions. People have told us they've had appendages or their feet run over by Border Patrol vehicles. And so this kind of the culture of cruelty then creates sort of a like that is known by people who are crossing the border. And so they attempt to flee and not be caught into the cycle of violence during an interdiction with Border Patrol. They flee, and in that fleeing from the Border Patrol agent are often also injured. And so it's both the known violence of the agent and then the act of fleeing that can create dangerous situations for a person who is then scattered from their group and lost. So
So part one really looks at these deadly apprehension methods and how they contribute not to apprehensions themselves, not to actually people being apprehended, but that how they are contributing to the disappearance in the wilderness areas of the borderlands.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Kate Morgan. And Kate is a representative of No More Deaths, which is one of the groups, along with La Coalición de Derechos Humanos, who produced the report Disappeared, How the U.S. Border Enforcement Agencies Are Fueling a Missing Persons Crisis. Now, just so people can get clear on this, there was something in the report that really struck me very, very sharply. And that's when there's a lot of references to low-intensity war zones. It seems like there is a sort of a low-intensity war being waged against immigrant people trying to come into the country for whatever reason and desperately trying to cross over and being willing to go through all this stuff. But there's actually a war being waged against these people, which I think a lot of people don't understand. They don't really get that this is a low-intensity war going on.
Yeah, and we use that term also just to refer to almost like, it's hard to describe the feeling of the borderlands. It really is something, if you haven't been to the border zone, we really encourage people to come witness what Arizona looks like, because the proliferation of surveillance towers, drones, agents on foot, agents on horseback, agents on ATV, trucks, those things, I think people really think of like, they think tend to think of like the wall, the physical wall themselves, but the wall is just sort of the aesthetic cover up for the 100-mile zone that looks like a war zone on the borderlands and feels like a war zone. Like the tension that is created around this militarization and the military presence of agents on the border is what we're referring to. And again, yes, it is definitely the reason why that infrastructure and those agents are here is to like manage or control the borderlands and against this so-called like onslaught of immigrants. But again, this is a border with countries that we actually have very friendly relationships to otherwise in the marketplace, right? Like NAFTA and TPP, the flow of goods over our border and the contracts that we have with corporations, both in Mexico and Central America, are quite friendly. It is when it comes to actually people and humanity in which the borderlands turns into a war zone.
Mm-hmm. But it's also very heavy, because when you look at things like, for instance, the fact that people are – that some of the things that you've already spoken about, where you talk about this thing of like the scattering of people, you know, which is really – when you're talking about people in a desert environment, people in a way, you know, when being scattered is actually a death sentence, you know, it's very difficult to – you know, for people who have no familiarity with the scene out there, where to go, how to survive it, suddenly are scattered and broken away from all the people that were actually with them and left to just wander around in the desert hoping to be able to survive. This is a really, I mean, not just cruel, but it's really an inhumane. It's actually, I would not hesitate to call these kinds of actions as crimes against humanity. You add in that and you look at, you know, scattering. You also look at the, you know, this question of, you know, the way that the physical violence that you've spoken about in terms of what the Border Patrol does to the people that they encounter. If they're not scattering them, if they're not beating the hell out of them, what happens? I mean, this is something I think people need to understand, the ferocity of this and what difference it makes in terms of the robbing the people who are trying to come into the country, robbing them of their humanity, and actually in many cases just ending up dead with, you know, it's a deadly direction that things go in. And many people do, in fact, disappear. Many people do die as a result of all this. This is something that I don't think a lot of people really understand, the cruelty involved in this.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as we are talking more about what the terrain is like and how deadly it is and how all of the agents and border enforcement strategies are contributing to the disappearance, I do want to name one particular policy, which is prevention through deterrence. Prevention through deterrence is an official policy of the U.S. government, and it was enacted in 1994, the same time that NAFTA happened. So the same time that we see pieces of the border wall going up is the same time that we know that more commerce is going to be conducted across the U.S.-Mexico border. And during that time, as the wall starts going up in urban areas, the reason is because of prevention through deterrence, the stated logic of which is that if you can make the journey as deadly, as traumatic, as horrible as possible, that people will not attempt to make it. And of course, we know this logic to be very flawed. This goes back to my point before, which is that people have very compelling reasons to leave and make such a long and deadly journey. And so prevention through deterrence actually doesn't result in fewer people crossing. It results in more people dying. It results in more people being forced into wilderness terrains where there's very few humans for them to come into contact with if they actually were in trouble and needed help, very few natural occurring water sources, and temperatures that in Arizona we see, you know, temperatures can be 120 in the summer and it can snow in the winter. So it's a terrain that is very extreme, and it is weaponized essentially by the U.S. government against people who will be crossing the border, resulting in a crisis of death and disappearance.
Mm-hmm. Now, we have just a couple more questions, and one I really want to get into. You can spend all the time you want on this one. The destruction of and interference with humanitarian aid, because there's a lot of people who I really admire them, the people who go out into the desert and try to leave containers of water and other things that would actually help people survive if they're out in the desert trying to get across, trying to get into the country and whatnot. And there's actually a willful destruction and interference with the ability of people to actually both distribute that aid, but also of people to actually get access to it. This is actually, you know, when you look at it, this is a homicidal act.
Yeah, so part two of our report does look at the interference and destruction of humanitarian aid. And this is something that we've been trying to shed light on for many years. At first, it was just anecdotally saying, we're putting water out in the desert. People are destroying it either by shooting it, splashing it, stomping it, kicking it, confiscating it. We believe it's Border Patrol, and people saying, what do you mean you think it's, you know, law enforcement? That can't be. Give us proof. So then we moved in like 2011, I guess, we started setting up trail cams at some of the water drop caches that were being vandalized repeatedly. And we actually caught instances of Border Patrol agents kicking our water gallons and confiscating blankets. And that did run, and we took it to Border Patrol, the sector chief at that time. He said that he would look into it. We asked if there were any disciplinary measures taken against those agents later on. They told us the official policy is that they don't release any information on discipline against the agents. Those agents were seen in the field later, so we presume that no discipline was taken against them. And it persisted. The vandalism persisted, and people continued to question whether it was just quote-unquote, you know, a few bad apples, or if it was, as we said, which was that we believed that people were encouraging each other to take these acts against our water drops. And so we said, fine, we'll do a quantitative analysis. We will give you the statistics on it. And we looked at the data that we had on water gallons and where they were left, where they were vandalized, and how frequently. We looked at the study period that we look at ranges from 2012 through 2015, and during that time, we distributed over 31,000 gallon jugs of water to migrant trails in southern Arizona. And what we found was that there was water gallons vandalized a total of 415 times, so on an average, at least two times a week during that study period, and that overall, more than 3,000 gallons of water jugs were vandalized in the approximately 800 square mile desert corridor area that we work in. And when we looked at the land jurisdictions that 800 square mile corridor covers, we found that there's a lot of different actors in a lot of different jurisdictions, you know, BLM land, ranch land, parks and rec land, and the only actor that had the ability to be consistently accessing all these land jurisdictions year after year after year is Border Patrol. And so along with the statistical analysis, our own eyewitness accounts, and also the trail cams, we encourage people to believe us when we say that U.S. law enforcement is a primary, perhaps not the only, definitely not the only actor, but a primary actor in the destruction of humanitarian aid supplies in this very deadly wilderness corridor. And that's something that's really important to remember, is that the acts of chasing and scattering, forcing people into wilderness area, then chasing and scattering them so that they don't have access to resources, and then eliminating the few resources that they might encounter. Yes, it's a deadly act.
Mm-hmm. Now, one more question for you. You have, you know, at the end of your report, you have a, basically you spend a lot of time on talking about what is to be done, the list of demands. And I thought it was really important for people to understand this, because you frame them in a way that actually, again, intensifies people's understanding of what's happening to people who are trying to, you know, come into this country in order to even to save their own lives, or to be able to help save their families back home, whatever. You know, for whatever reason people are coming in, they are being systematically destroyed in one way or another. And you folks have not only done this really important report, but you've also, at the end of it, you've stated a list of demands, which I thought it would be important for people to understand or hear a little bit about those demands, what they are, and take it away.
Okay. So one of our demands is simply that there actually is an investigation into agents who are destroying water gallons, and that there is a known disciplinary measure for interacting with agents who are caught interfering with aid. We also ask that we ask for international organizations such as the United Nations to investigate the abuse and the forms of violence that are being used by the U.S. Border Patrol against migrants. We believe that the kind of violence that we're seeing, the death and disappearance, does constitute crimes against humanity. And we want people at an international level to be paying attention to what's happening on the U.S. border. And we also are asking, actually, for reparations for the families of the disappeared and the deceased. We believe that the loss of life that's happening on the border is intentional, and it's being caused by the U.S. government. And we believe that the U.S. government should be accountable for those acts and for the deaths and disappearance of people. And particularly in the case of the disappeared, where people are actually never able to bury a loved one, the reverberations of that trauma, the echo throughout communities and families when a person dies and there's no way to, you know, to like, there's no way for that person's ability. I mean, I hate to like tie someone's life to capital, but many times the people who are crossing are the primary breadwinners in a family. And so their death or their disappearance, not only is it traumatic, but it actually is materially important and materially traumatic as well as psychologically traumatic. And when it is due to U.S. government policies, we believe that those actors, those agencies should be accountable to the families in the very least in a material way, and pay reparations to the families.
Mm-hmm. Now, just one more thing, just in closing here, you've obviously spent a lot of time, a lot of your heart is into this. You know, I'd really like to, it's an extremely important thing, and I'd really like you to leave people with something, just something from yourself, from your own heart, about what is it, what makes you do this, and why is it so damn important for people to wake up and pay attention and put a stop to this horror that's going on?
I think this is what's happening on the U.S. border. You know, someone listening to me speak about it might feel anger or rage or frustration or sadness about what's happening on the border. And I certainly feel those feelings too, but it is being here every day and witnessing the consequences of the border, witnessing the acts of Border Patrol agents and the U.S. government, and being here, it's such a visceral experience. it's an experience that has changed my life, and it's one of those experiences that I felt like once I knew it, I couldn't unknow it. And I don't necessarily like identify with the U.S. government, but I acknowledge that I live in this country, and as a white middle class college educated citizen of the United States, I have a lot of privileges that mean that my family and my community is not being impacted by these policies the same way other people's. And I felt like I wanted to be here to use my privileges and to witness and to act in a way in solidarity with people who were experiencing this kind of violence. And that, again, was something that was drawn out of me from being here on the borderlands and seeing the consequences of what were happening and feeling it so deeply in my heart that I felt like this is where I wanted to stand. This was the place that I wanted to be. And these were communities who I wanted to be in solidarity with.
Mm-hmm. Very, very important. One more thing. I lied. One more thing. Where can people get in touch with the organizations? Where can they get a copy of this report?
Yeah. So if folks want to read more about the report, they should visit the website, thedisappearedreport.org. And there you'll be able to download the report itself and read more of our fact sheets, see some of the materials that we've published. You can also follow nomoredeaths.org to find out more information on the organization itself or to get involved as a volunteer.
All right, Kate. So thank you very much for joining us today.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
That brings us to the end of yet another show. I'd like to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and engineer, Gary Baca. And each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. That's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com.
One, two,
well, you better